Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We are here today to take public testimony on two bills. One is House Bill 5014, which is the Department of Education Operations Budget Bill, and the other one is House Bill 5015, which is the Department of Education Grant and Aid Bill, and I'll open the public hearing on both of those bills. We have a large number of people signed up to testify today, and it's my intention to hear as many people as we possibly can. We're up against some time constraints this morning. The House goes into session at 10:45, and we actually lose possession of this room at some point in time. So to kind of set some guidelines here, what I'd like to do is to ask people to limit their testimony and not take up more than 3 minutes so that we have an opportunity to get as many people in as possible. And what I'll be doing is calling people up in panels of three, and then I'll let you know who the next group of three will be so those people can get ready to come down. And we have an overflow room that's full of people. Those people happen to be upstairs, so they're going to need to pay attention on the monitors and then get their morning aerobic exercise by running down the stairs and being here when it's their turn to testify. The committee welcomes written testimony. If you did bring written testimony with you and you'd like it to have it handed out to members of the committee, please give it to Ms. McGlashan, our LFO staffer, and she'd be glad to get it distributed to us. If you find that the time frames get too compressed for you and you have written testimony, we would also be glad to receive that if you don't want to actually stay and make verbal testimony. And please, if you do take that position, be very assured that we do pay attention, a great deal of attention, to the written material that we get, and the material that is handed in will become part of the permanent record of the committee proceedings. The what I'm going to do is I do have invited testimony, and I'll be calling those people up to testify first. Then I'll be moving to the people that came here from more than 100 miles away in consideration of their travel needs. And then I'll be moving to the people in the order that they signed up. So please bear with us as we work through managing the process here. And again, I do thank you all. I know that coming to testify in the legislature is a huge commitment that you make, and probably most of you are giving up at least 2 days of your time to be here. And I want you to know that we really appreciate your commitment to education programs, and we're very interested in hearing what you have to say.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Could we again use the chairs on either side
absolutely.
Of us for the overflow?
If there are people that want to come and take up these chairs on the sides here, we won't call on you to testify, but it's better than standing around. I think that's it. And I might also note that the fire marshal is very strict with us in not allowing people to be in this room unless they're sitting down. And I understand that the people that we have at the door are part of the process. So I'm going to bring forward for the first panel Tamara Haas and Joyce Bernheim. And on deck is Judy Newman, Camelia Abel, Cara Faddis, and those are the next three panels. So could Tamara Haas and Joyce Bernstein come forward, please? Not here? Okay, then let me call forward Judy Newman, Amelia Abel, and Carl Faddis. And on deck is Tracy Williamson, Joe Brook, Horace Rogers. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Chair, Representative Morgan, and members of the committee. My name is Judy Newman, and I'm the chairperson of the Legislative Committee of the State Interagency Coordinating Council, the SICC. The SICC is the statutorily required advisory council for early intervention and early childhood special education. The membership is governor-appointed, and it includes parents, service providers, and representatives of state agencies serving birth to five-year-old children with special needs and their families. The charge of the SICC is to advise state policymakers on policy and unmet needs and budgets and the effective and efficient coordination of services across agencies and programs. Oregon has had a very long-standing commitment to children from birth to five with disabilities. So the state law has ensured services to these children as early as 1983, which is over 20 years. And these services have been in every single county since 1983. They've been mandated in federal and state law for the last 10 years under IDEA. We thank you and all the legislators that have preceded you for your unwavering commitment over all these years. That's a long history. Yesterday, you heard about these programs, and I want to just highlight a few key points. First of all, early intervention, early childhood special ed provides services for birth to five-year-old children who have developmental disabilities, delays, and sensory impairments. Some examples of these would be Down syndrome, other genetic disorders, autism, deafness, blindness, cerebral palsy, emotional disturbance, and communication disorders. Some examples of the services that we provide include speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, specialized preschool programs, behavior and social skills trainings. As you know, kids in this state from birth to five don't have any public preschool available, except a few have Head Start. So the challenge is figuring out where to serve these children. Early intervention, early childhood special ed serves kids where they naturally are, which is in homes, in preschools, in community programs, and in specialized programs. The focus of services are to help parents and other caregivers learn how to take care of their child with special needs. And these services are all individualized. Every child doesn't get all the services, just what they need. EIECSE is a key partner in the early childhood system in each local community. Other agencies and programs like Healthy Start, Head Start, crisis nurseries, Cocoon, they rely, and physicians as well as child care providers really rely on the availability of early intervention, early childhood special ed, so that they can refer children after they do a screening that might be having a problem. They rely on the expertise of the early intervention folks to serve the kids. One thing that's really been really exciting, yes.
50 seconds.
Okay, great. I just want to highlight on the handout I gave you that that these programs are beginning to show outcomes. And I think it's really important to see that every child in the program is tracked for developmental progress. 98% of them are making progress in their areas of delay. And there's a pilot that has just finished around the state in a few counties. And we're finding 10 to 20% of the kids going to kindergarten no longer need special education services. So we're pretty encouraged by those outcomes, as well as every child starts ready to learn. So thank you. I want to remind you of the very important investment of early intervention and want you to encourage you to continue that.
Thank you.
I want to introduce Amelia is next. And I've known Amelia since she's been 2 weeks old. I was her home visitor. And her mother called me in January and said she had a goal of speaking on behalf of people with disabilities. So we thought this was an opportunity.
Amelia, you're welcome. Thank you for coming.
Hi, my name is Amelia Abel. I am 13 years old. I was born with a disability called Down syndrome. I was an early intervention. I have friends named Kim. She helped me with my speech. There are people who have disabilities, people like me, who need extra help. I like going to school. I like to spell. I like to read a lot. I read books at home. I like math, too. Some people with disability need aids at school to help them learn. I like having special aids so I can go to regular classrooms. people with disabilities have a hard time because they are different. Sometimes they look different. Sometimes their minds look different. Sometimes other boys and girls don't treat people with disabilities so well. It is hard having a disability. Sometimes students don't include me. I feel sad. Sometimes it is hard for parents to, they have special needs and need help. My parents say that early arrangements help them a lot. Please donate money to schools and early arrangements. Thank you for letting me talk to you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much.
Very good. Very good.
Good morning, Madam Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Joe Brooke. I live in St. Helens. And this little guy hiding down here is Jesse. Jesse just turned 5, and he's received early intervention and early special childhood education services in St. Helens. Jesse was a healthy, normal baby, and at 18 months old, he got a mild virus. We thought he had an ear infection. Over the weekend, he literally stopped talking. Before that, he had several words. He stopped talking. He stopped babbling. He stopped vocalizing in any way except to cry if he was in distress. We sought lots of help and didn't get any until he was 2. Our physician finally, we got referral to early intervention, and they've just been a lifesaver. We had speech therapy in our home, and I'm sorry. We started sign language almost immediately. It was only 2, but we started sign language, and the words that he had lost immediately came back. He was able to talk to me again. It also helped immediately with the frustration level that he and we both were experiencing, but especially he. His temper tantrums immediately went away. He was, instead of pointing and grunting, he was able to tell me what he wanted. He could say cookie. He could say more. He could say, he had a lot of words. It was immensely helpful. And to have them come to our home for a 2-year-old who, you know, does not necessarily work as well when they go out to therapy was extremely valuable. When he was 3 and we started into the early childhood special ed, the therapist started him on picture boards, which is he had his own book that he carried around, and he could point to a picture and express an entire thought or feeling, which is extremely helpful with people other than the immediate family. He was able to go to our friend's house, have play dates for the first time, and be able to express whatever he needed. My goal at that time, and all the way up to that time, had been to hear him say mama again, which is one of the words that he had lost. And when he was 2 months before he turned 4, he was able to say that again for the first time. That was his first word that he was able to say on demand anytime he wanted. Our physician explained that the virus caused a swelling in his brain, which affected the speech center, and in essence, it was very much like having a stroke for him. That Jesse and his therapist, when they worked together, were literally building neural connections around the blockage or whatever the problem was in the brain. And our physician emphasized strongly that this was critical, that he receive early and often treatment in order to, you know, reestablish those neural pathways around.
30 seconds.
Thank you. Jesse has made remarkable improvement, and we're hoping that by the time he's in first or second grade that he won't have a noticeable change or a difference in his speech. We've been very thankful to have this available in our community. And on the bear that Jesse brought today, he dictated to me what he wanted to say. It said, "My name is Jesse. I can talk good now. I work hard to talk good." Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sir. Good morning. My name is Forrest Rogers, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. I'm the proud father of the 3-year-old who is protesting in the back of the room at this moment. Her name is Ella. I have some written testimony for you. She's tired of hearing me talk already. Ella has recently been diagnosed with Rett syndrome, an uncommon genetic syndrome that affects an infant's ability to plan and organize motion, mobility, and speech. Unlike Jesse, whose affections were caused by a virus, hers is caused by a genetic scrambling that manifests itself within the first year of life. Many Rett babies develop the ability to speak and walk, and then inexplicably and suddenly lose that ability. Over 2 years, we were involved in testing, research, and diagnostic therapeutics to try to identify the source of this delay, which was pervasive on all dimensions of her life. We were fortunate to have been referred to the local hospital and their physiatrists and therapies, and then through the professional talents of the St. Charles Medical Center, were referred to early intervention. Almost 2 years ago, Ella began the early intervention program, and she is now able to primitively walk and explore. She has become a sociable, social, and at times talkative creature. She is beginning to approximate words, and she has developed a much stronger relationship with her two siblings, who are also in the room and are being uncharacteristically quiet at the moment.
Good care.
Good care from Representative Johnson, our good friend. The early intervention program, I call the family of experts that has not only worked with Ella, but worked with her siblings and her parents and our extended family to create a learning environment that focuses on Ella's goals, focuses on her progress, and gives us all the opportunity to work together to ensure that she continues to progress. We may never know when Ella will lose the skills she's already developed, and they may go away forever. But we do know that the experts that we have consulted in the Rett clinics tell us that the early intervention training she has had and the learning trajectory that she is on increases the probability that she won't lose skills, and that if she were to lose them, she would more quickly regain or retain them. An adult who has an accident and loses some of these basic skills often has the benefit of healthcare-provided therapies. Children with these kinds of syndromes, such as Rett, do not. The early intervention program is valued by the private sector of healthcare and is one option that is available to families that would be not available to anyone else. So your support for this program and the people who affect this program throughout the state, in the counties and the communities, make a real difference. And we thank you for your support of them and our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. Great testimony. The chair calls again. If Tamara Hass and Joyce Bernheim are here, please come forward. I call Carl Faddis, Tracy Williamson, and Rebel Thornton. Any of those people, please come forward.
Aren't you special? Are you going to cry?
I love it.
I don't have their names, so. Go ahead.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Representative Morgan, for having us here today, and representatives. Thank you for allowing us time to testify in support of House Bill 5015 and its funding for regional programs.
For the record?
Yes.
Your name, please?
Tamara Hass.
Thank you.
And this is Joyce Bernheim. I'm sorry about that. Yes, my name is Tamara Hass, and I'm testifying on behalf of regional programs. Okay. And we are supporting House Bill 5015 and its funding for regional programs which serve children with low-incidence disabilities, for example, deaf-blind, hearing and vision impaired, severely orthopedically impaired, and autism. We are here today to share information on how the support of regional programs supports these low-incidence disabilities in children in our educational settings. some history, regional programs were formed in the early 80s in direct response to the inequitable and often unavailable services for students with low incidence disabilities. And we are here today to share three key points regarding the how supporting regional programs for the state of Oregon is a cost efficient and provides equal access and accountability to our students who represent these very low incidence disabilities. First of all, let's look at cost efficiency. It is difficult for smaller districts to hire small pieces of a specialist time. For example, Canby has 25 students with autism spectrum disorder and receives about 2 days a week of support from an autism specialist. Regional is able to hire a full-time employee and assign him or her to serve Canby 2 days a week and another district the other 3 days a week. Not many educators are in this position to be able to act as private contractors and work for several districts in order to have full-time employment. And with the growing personnel shortages in these highly specialized areas, the ability to attract staff is critical. Ability to move specialized equipment around. If there were no regional programs and a blind child moved into a district and had a number of assistive technology devices on their IEP, then the district would need to purchase this equipment to support the child. Say a year or two later, the child moves into another district or out of state. The current district now has equipment, but no other blind child to use it. With regionals, under the scenario just mentioned, when the child moved, the regional program would issue the child what he or she needed from the equipment bank. When the child moved, the equipment would go back in. Okay, thank you. And I want to reinforce the idea that regional programs are a very cost-effective approach to supporting our state. And also, it provides equal access to children throughout the state who do require specialized services in an educational setting. And, for example, in Portland, it would be easy to hire a full-time specialist to serve children who are very needy and are in our educational system. However, in our more rural areas, for example, the Dalles or Drain, where there are only a couple children who may represent this population, it is more difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bernheim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for having us. I am the parent of an 8-year-old boy with autism.
For the record, could you identify yourself?
For the record, I am Joyce Bernheim.
Thank you.
And I am the parent of an 8-year-old boy with autism being served by the Columbia Regional Program in Portland. For the past 20 years, was a healthcare lawyer in one of the large regional law firms. Because of the needs of my son and others whom I met, I felt compelled to withdraw from my partnership last year and devote my abilities to improving outcomes for children with autism. The need is severe. Imagine having a child born with a moderately advanced state of Alzheimer's disease and having that condition for life. That is the level of burden that children and families face who have autism. And it's critically important to us to gain access to expertise and services to help us understand what this disease is and learn how to work with it and get the maximum outcomes possible. We have that level of support and expertise in the regional programs. It is more than simply administrative and economic efficiency. I have to emphasize that it is the experience, it's the judgment, it's the ability to work with large populations of affected children and to understand very rapidly what are the maximum interventions in any given case to help achieve outcomes for these students. It has been a very disrupted picture in the last several sessions with budget cuts. We have an epidemic of autism, which is cycling through the country and the world. As a matter of fact, in January, statistics were released on a 10-year study out of Atlanta, Georgia, showing a 10-fold increase in rates of autism. I spoke a couple of months ago with one of the leading developmental pediatricians in the state who looked at me with a look of horror on her face and said, I don't know what's happening. I have seen more children diagnosed with autism coming into my practice in the last 6 months than I have seen in 25 years of practice. We have we have a tidal wave of children with autism coming into the system. We cannot afford to undermine the support.
Ms. Bernheim, 30 seconds.
Okay. The supports that are available for them. And I just want to add it, that it works. We have more techniques that can bring good outcomes to children. My son was diagnosed with, he was at the first percentile in every dimension when he first came into early intervention. He's now 8 years old. He's reading above grade level. He's meeting his math benchmarks. He's swimming. He's skiing. He's playing piano. And it works. Please preserve it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good testimony. Chair calls Carl Faddis, Tracy Williamson, Rebel Thornton. And on deck is Sharon Lewis. And I would next like to call Senator David Nelson. So if there's anybody in the office that is listening, please have Senator Nelson head this way. And wait a minute. I missed out. Let's bring forward the panel that is next up. After that, I'd like to call Sharon Lewis and Ross Shelley, Jess, and Logan Day. And then I would like to do Senator David Nelson and Judge Pryor, the group that you brought from Eastern Oregon on the Frontier Learning Network, to follow up.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tracy Williamson, and I represent the families of disabled and challenged children in Klamath County. And I would like to sincerely thank all of you for giving me this opportunity to tell you a little bit about my son, Donovan, who's sitting next to me. My family adopted Donovan, now 5 years old, when he was 11 months old. He was born with Down syndrome, chronic lung disease, and numerous other medical problems. We were told that first year that he would most likely not survive until Christmas. Numerous doctors and agencies had given up on Donovan and felt his case was hopeless. So where were we to turn for help? We turned to early intervention, the one agency that sees potential in every child, no matter what their disability is. The services they provided, such as physical therapy, speech therapy, and classroom education with his peers, has enabled Donovan to not only survive, but to thrive. He now walks, almost talks, laughs, cries, giggles, hugs, kisses, and even gets into mischief once in a while. Our family and Donovan owe this all to early intervention and early childhood special education. Please do not cut the funding for these vital services. Children like Donovan are depending on them and on you to help them when no one else will. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Durham, and I'm from Clackamas County. I'd like to introduce you to my 3-year-old son, Jalen. Jalen was born with Pierre-Robin syndrome, which is a condition which causes the lower jaw to underdevelop and also causes the tongue to fall back and block the airway, making eating and breathing virtually impossible. When he was little, Jalen needed a trach, and he still has a gastrostomy button to help with feeding. When he was 3 months old, he underwent a difficult surgery to lengthen his jaw. At about that time, when he was 3 months old, he also started receiving services from early intervention. Initially, Jalen received physical therapy, feeding therapy, and speech therapy services in our home.
Excuse me, he is making our recording system.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. As you can see, he does get in trouble a little bit sometimes. By the time Jalen was 18 months old, he had progressed enough that he didn't need physical therapy anymore. He still receives feeding therapy and speech therapy in a group setting. However, we have every hope that by the time he's in kindergarten, he at least will no longer need the feeding therapy services. And we also hope that at some point in his early years of elementary school, he'll be able to be mainstreamed into a regular classroom. And none of this would be possible without the services from early intervention that Jalen has received since he was born. Jalen benefited from receiving services at a time that was crucial to his development. We know now that Jalen has a better chance to reach his full potential as he grows up because of the services that he received at such a young age. We appreciate that as legislators, you're faced with very difficult decisions this year, especially when it comes to budget. However, we implore you to protect the funding for early intervention and protect our children who so desperately need it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I will call Sharon Lewis and the Day family. And on deck is Senator David Nelson and Judge Laura Pryor and the group from Northeastern Oregon.
I'm trying to get there.
Please, good morning. My name's Molly, and this is my daughter Soraya, and she's been receiving early intervention services since she was right about 3 months old. She was born healthy, and as a month went past and 2 months went past, after numerous visits to the doctor, something wasn't right. And so we found out that she was blind, and so she received, we went up to OHSU to do a surgery on her left eye, hoping that because she had a cataract in her left and her retina was folded on her right, they would remove the cataract and she could have sight. Lo and behold, the retina was detached, so there was no chance of her having any eyesight. As time passed, the early intervention services were phenomenal in our family. I had no understanding of what to do as a new mom, and I had no services that could help me. And because we were right in the middle financially of making too much money and not being poor enough, we couldn't receive certain services. So early intervention was the only thing that helped us. As time went on, we realized that she not only was blind, that she had microcephaly. She has a hemivertebrae in her lower spine, and they just found out that she has scoliosis now from it. And along with that, she has developmental delays. And so she continually has needed more and more service. And so we understand that things are, money is tight, and we understand what's happening at this time, but if the services were cut, my daughter would not be walking. A year ago, she could not even roll over. And now she's walking and she's starting to talk, and she is one of the happiest children you will ever meet. She smiles continuously, and she is she's just a very happy baby. And so I am very grateful for the early intervention services, and I'm grateful for what they have done with as little as they have been given. The teachers are phenomenal.
30 seconds.
They've shown such love to our children, not just to our daughter, but to our son. And on top of that, we had foster children, and one of our foster child also qualified for early intervention services. She was hearing impaired as well as developmentally delayed. So we've had time to be involved with them, and so we're grateful for them.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Carl Faddis. I'm from Eugene, and I was minding my own business at 48 years old, and we gave birth to our daughter, Libby Amber. Wasn't quite expecting that. She's sort of our cosmic giggle. She was born with Down syndrome and a whole list of different things that we needed to deal with and still are dealing with. I'm here to say to you that if it had not been for early intervention, Libby would not have come as far as she's come today. This is really about bravery. I just sat in the hallway and watched children and parents who have much more backbone to deal with these things than I will ever have or you will ever have. And I'm here to tell you that the critical time that it comes for you to make a vote or to advocate for us, I just pray that you'll have the wisdom to see, you know, I'm not here to sell early intervention, but you truly, truly are given this opportunity, and it is not ours, but it is yours. And I'm reminded of an image of someone being rescued in a fast-moving river. Sometimes it comes down to just a digit that a firefighter or a rescue worker can get a hold of. And it's the difference between being swept away or not. And so many of these children and these parents are looking to you, not only for wisdom to see through, to see these opportunities. I'm here also to say that I do not have the resources to purchase these services for myself. If it had not been for your help and early intervention for these services being available to us, I could never have afforded these things for Libby. And so Libby now sits and she doesn't have any language. So we're sitting the other morning at morning coffee, and her poison, of course, is apple juice. And we're sitting around, and she says, and all of a sudden she goes like this, and we start verbalizing for her. She says, start your day
30 seconds
with Libby. And this is the sign for in, but for her it's very focused, like in. Well, there's no sign for hot tub, for Pete's sake. So what does she do? She says, ah, ah. She was reaching for it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we wept like babies and jumped in the hot. I don't even think we pulled the cover off of the hot tub. This is a result of early intervention, and that's why they call it early. So I'm grateful to you all very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Lewis. This is my daughter, Zoe. She's one of three wonderful daughters that I'm blessed to parent. 1 year ago, at the start of the infamous and now seemingly never-ending special session season, I sat here before the governor and several of you and spoke about my experiences as Zoe's parent as a child with developmental disabilities. Did you want to say hello?
Hi, I'm Zoe, and my name's Zoe, and my...
How old are you?
I'm six.
And you like school?
I like school very much. My mom picks me up, and I'm Marina's sister.
Say thank you.
Thank you.
Now, just over a year later, I sit before you as a parent advocate who is connected with hundreds of other parents from around the state whose lives are enriched by a baby or young child with a disability. Many of them can't be here today. They've sent their bears instead. These parents, we talk in the middle of the night, if and when our kids finally go to sleep. We email during those brief moments of peace when our children are otherwise occupied. We find solace in laughter in each other as we compare stories and notes and treatments and ideas. The diversity among these Oregon families is amazing, but the common thread that I hear again and again is, I don't know what I would do without early intervention, or my insurance will not cover the cost of any services. All the other public programs have been depleted, and I cannot afford private therapies or assistance. Or my personal favorite, doctors have told me that my child would never fill in the blank, walk, talk, communicate, tie a shoe, ride a bike. But the people at Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education have taught my child to do these things. You will hear but a few of these stories today. Early interventions restored my faith in what I knew to be true.
Shh, I need to be quiet for a minute, okay?
When Zoe was born, but somehow became muddled along our early path through hospitalizations and setbacks and cultural attitudes about people with disabilities. My belief that she is a unique human being with incredible strengths and much to teach us a child whose biggest barriers will come from lack of appropriate supports in a world that may not understand people and respect people with disabilities. Most importantly, all that I hope for my other daughters, I also hope for Zoe. Ultimately, to live a happy, independent life pursuing her personal passions. I'm proud to say that Zoe attends a regular kindergarten in Portland Public Schools in large part due to the early intervention services she received. I hope that you will take a moment today to see some of the many families who have come to the Capitol today to support early intervention, early childhood special education. We expect over 1,000 bears out on the steps today, and I know that everyone has a busy day, but I hope that you can appreciate that. We've sent a very clear message in our attendance here today. We value these programs, and in the difficult decisions you make, we appreciate your investment in our children.
Thank you very much. Great panel. I call forward the Day family, and then Senator David Nelson, you're up after the Day family, and then Judge Pryor. Good morning, Mr. Day.
I'll yield the time to Senator Nelson if you like first.
You have children. You
okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Ross Day. I'm here with my wife, Shelley, my three-month-old Logan, who I hope is asleep, and, of course, my three-year-old, the star of the show, Jeff Day, who some of you might remember from last session, as he was the official smiler and drooler for Senator Roger Beyer. I'm here today on behalf of early intervention, and I think I want to start off by saying what I've heard already from many people, and that is thank you. I don't think you guys get that enough. Thank you. Thank you for everything, for the investments you guys have made. Thank you for the investments you guys have made in the past. I can tell you, you all see me around here pounding the halls, lurking the halls on other issues. Not many people know that my family receives early intervention services as well. And I can tell you that most of you know Jess, and you know him to be a very happy, sociable little boy. I know that if it wasn't for the early intervention services we received starting at 3 months old, he wouldn't be the boy that all of you know him to be. And so I'm very appreciative, and thank you so much for the investment that you've made. I also know that you've got tough decisions ahead of you, and I do not envy the position you're in at all. And I just appreciate your attention to this matter and your concern. It means a lot to us. And like the previous speaker said, you've got hundreds of families here. That's how, that demonstrates exactly how important it is to us. Like I said, Jess is 3 years old. Jess has cerebral palsy. He was very sick when he was first born, and we almost lost him. But being the tough fighter that he is, he made it through. It was kind of a difficult time for us, aside from just the fact that he got sick. I was in my last semester of law school and studying for that little quiz they make us take in the summer, and we didn't know what to do or how to help, and early intervention came in and really helped us out. Jess doesn't walk or talk, and he doesn't feed himself yet, although he loves to drink bottles of milk. But he is a happy little boy, and like I said, most of you know him and know that he loves to smile and blow kisses. And can you wave? Can you say hi? Can you wave? Say hi. I just want to thank you for what you have done. It really means a lot to all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Bay, did you want to add to the comments?
I just want to say that as a new parent, it was very hard to have a child with a disability, and I was learning how to be a mother. And if early intervention did not come out to our house, I would have not been able to even know what to do, where to start. And, they were not only teaching my child how to do things, such as just rolling over, but they were also showing me how to get plugged into other parents and to other services that are available. And so please, just when you're voting, just keep Jess in mind and realize that that he's the little boy he is today because of early intervention, and we are the parents we can be today with their help as well. So they do a lot more than just teach our children, and they teach the parents too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson, would you like to? I don't want to make you sit up there while you talk about the
through this.
Thank you very much for coming. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Yes,
today.
Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee. This is a little more mundane issue that I'm talking about, although I do have a grandson that has autism, and so I do understand a little bit what these folks go through. But I'm here to talk about infrastructure, which is not quite as exciting as other things. The open network, I am the state senator from Pendleton. My district goes from Boardman to Imnaha. It's about 250 miles east and west and about 100 miles deep. So our folks out there need access. The open network is the infrastructure that delivers the technology. One of the key things I think that is important there is the TESA program, Technology Enhanced Scholastic Assessment. That was a new program started in 1999 and has been building up. The open program basically serves about 5 out of 6 of the children in the state of Oregon. That would be 500 out of the 600,000. I'm just encouraging you to make provisions for that, to keep that infrastructure alive and going. And I appreciate the opportunity. And I also want to thank you for the hard work that you're doing, because it's not fun, I know, sometimes. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Chair calls Judge Pryor, Rita Rattray, Anthony Lanny, and Rob Myers. And on deck is David Campbell and a panel made up of Pat Bedore, Heidi Schack, Carrie Hogland, Maureen Casey.
He has not in.
Senator Ferrioli, would you wish to testify?
Just briefly, ma'am.
If you could come up, then we would be glad to give you the courtesy. Senator, please proceed.
Madam Chairman, for the record, Ted Ferrioli, District 30, Oregon's largest district, 34,000 square miles, stretching from Marion County and parts of Clackamas County all the way over to, the Nevada Idaho border.
Wow, what's known as a car-killing district.
Yes, ma'am. You get plenty of windshield time in District 30. Madam Chairman, I'm here to support House Bill 5515 and the Dash 2 Amendment, particularly its appropriation for the Frontier Learning Network. As I just explained, time and distance are the enemies of knowledge and learning in rural Oregon. Teachers have to deal with and parents and patrons and school districts have to deal with those two enemies, time and distance. Bringing in services to our communities, new technologies to our communities along this huge geography is just a huge challenge. In addition to that, teachers in rural areas tend to average about 15% less in earnings than in the urban areas. So recruiting, attracting, and retaining high-quality teachers is a difficult challenge. The interesting thing about what this project does, the Frontier Learning Network, is it gives us a tool to combat the effects of time and distance and the difficulty in attracting and retaining high-quality teachers. It does that through technology. We have mobile classrooms. We have satellite linkage. We have the ability to find the very best curriculums and the very best presenters and make them available in a circuit that's connected by physical movements of teaching trailers that are connected by satellites to central distribution systems. And that way we can bring the highest quality technology and the best teachers out to the rural communities in a way that delivers knowledge and learning. And those things are absolutely critical if we're going to have kids in the rural areas that come through their educational experience with the knowledge and the ability and the tools to succeed right along with their more urban counterparts. So the Frontier Learning Network, in fact, is exactly the kind of thing that we need to retain and to maintain in order to truly offer a reasonable and fair access to new technologies and education in the rural areas, especially those that are federally designated as frontier. 34,000 square miles, about 100,000 people, just as all the other Senate districts are. You do the math, it's less than a third of a person per square mile. and to aggregate the demands in our school districts and to provide the tools that we really need to get these kids a high-quality education. It's a tough challenge. It's been met with the Frontier Learning Network. We'd like you to insert the Dash 2 amendments, which is an appropriation to continue the Frontier Learning Network, and to keep the kids in those rural communities at the frontier of knowledge and learning. I thank you for your indulgence and your courtesy, and I'll turn it over to the experts that helped develop this plan.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee.
Judge Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I am the Gillum County judge, which means I am the chair of the Board of Commissioners, and I also have judicial function. I'm a juvenile judge. I can't help but make some comment about what has gone before you, before us, our testimony today. I'm here to testify in support of 5515, but I want to make a comment about the other bill for just a second. I have great respect for what all of you are dealing with, and it's a testimony like you've heard today that makes us all remember why we're engaged in the process in the first place. The great budget tragedy that we're all dealing with one way or another is pitting the most needy against the most needy in different ways. I doubt that you're going to see many children that are going to be able to be here from Malheron, Lake, Umatilla, Harney, Wallala, Grant, Union, Sherman, Morrow, Douglas, Coos, Tillamook, Gillum, Wheeler, and Crook, and Curry. I'm going to ask you to please remember, in all of the range of things that you're seeing here before you, all the bills, that these children will grow up, and they will still have needs. We're very inclined to be incredibly compassionate to children when they're small, but they're no less our children as they grow up, and they still have needs that we have to address. Specifically, I would like to tell you why I'm involved in supporting 5515. Not only do the rural counties that I've enumerated here have these same kinds of children as you've seen before, but we also are beginning to have an incredible crisis in our basic education for all children. I got involved for three reasons. One is because of need in basic education. One is because of the need in early intervention and a great overwhelming need for economic development to address all those needs. And I just want to make one point to you, and that is in Condon, the school district, the county seat in my county, there's 750 people. The school district there has a budget of about $2 million. We're going to have to cut about $400,000 this year. Losing a $2 million income or a $500,000 income in that community can be catastrophic.
30 seconds, Judge.
So I hope that you will consider the compendium of all of this. I know it's very difficult for you, and I hate to see us pitting one need against another, but it's a system that we have. I want to encourage you. We remain encouraged in rural Oregon, and I hope that you will support 5515 and its amendment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Rita Rattray, Anthony Lanny, and Rob Myers. And on deck is David Campbell, Pat Bedore, Heidi Schack, Carrie Hogland, and Maureen Casey. Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers, and I live in Condon. On the front of the building, it says common benefits should be justly apportioned, not equally apportioned. And I think that's critical to what it is that I want to talk about briefly today, and that's the concept of equity versus equality. What we're looking for in terms of educational services in rural and remote rural areas is not equality, it's equity. And the other thing I want to make sure that the committee understands, and anybody else who will listen, is that we do not perceive this as an urban versus rural issue. We believe that there is a moral imperative and a collective obligation to educate all the children in the state of Oregon, not just ours, but the kids in downtown Portland or downtown Medford or downtown Eugene as well. And what I'd like to do very quickly in order to be able to point up the difference between what we consider to be equality and equity is look at the courses that various high schools offer around the state. And I want to preface my comments by saying that, once again, I'm not doing this to point up some sort of inequity between urban and rural schools. What I'm saying is that we're already at what we consider to be a basic level of education. The average metro high school in Portland offers 200 courses. The average frontier rural high school offers between 35 and 40. Now, on the one hand, you could consider that to be unfair. Frankly, we don't. We couldn't offer 200 courses. We don't have the kids to take them, so it makes no sense for us to do that. So while equality doesn't exist, equity may exist. My point is that we're on the very brink of falling off the edge of where our kids can get any kind of education at all. And I think that's a critical point to make with regard to the manner in which the Frontier Learning Network addresses this problem. The Frontier Learning Network is arguably the most innovative, forward-thinking distance learning program in the United States. It is the most cost-effective manner of delivering services to rural and frontier rural students. So in that context, my point very specifically is that we are not a part of the problem. We consider ourselves to be a very integral part of the solution. Our outreach programs do not extend statewide due primarily to lack of connectivity, which we anticipate will be pretty much mitigated and taken care of by fall. We work very closely with Portland Public Schools on a program that Rita will tell you about shortly. We've got a partnership with Portland Public Schools that's been mutually beneficial now for 4 years, and we value our relationship with them very closely. Thank you. Really, I'm not going to say any more. I think that's the essence of what I'm here to ask you today, is to consider a reinstatement of the Frontier Learning Network funding, because this is not new money. This money was allocated and authorized in 1999 by over a two-thirds majority vote in the House and a unanimous vote in the Senate. The reason it was passed was because it was a fundamentally good idea, and it remains no less today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chair Representative Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Anthony Lanny. I'm the superintendent at the North Central Education Service District. The Frontier Learning Network is a national award-winning distance learning program. The distance learning is research-based. I have been involved in distance learning since 1985. The research indicates that up to three times, if a teacher makes a face-to-face meeting with students, their achievement increases in a distance learning scenario. By moving the teacher and the classroom from school to school over a period of a semester for at least three times, we magnify the achievement of the students involved. And the achievement is high, and the number of dropouts is very low. Traditional web-based courses have a relatively high dropout rate due to the lack of human interaction with the teacher. Anybody who is taught understands that that's the basis of all learning. It's a research model. The advantages of VTEL are the voice-video interaction, but VTEL is a tough beast to master. At the Frontier Learning Network, we have become experts in delivering courses by VTEL and teaching people how to use their machines. The legislature provided every high school in the state with a, I'm using a trade name, VTEL is a video conferencing, unit, and it is a tricky unit to use. We have taught our schools, and we make our expertise available on a statewide basis for people who need the instruction and how to run it. Many schools don't use their machines because of the problems with running them. We have conquered those, and we offered that expertise to other schools throughout the state. It's a national award-winning program.
30 seconds, sir.
Yes, ma'am. I would like to offer 1505-2 amendment to the committee. and offer any time if anybody has any questions, whatever, please get in touch with me. I believe my name and phone number are on the materials that have been delivered to the committee, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. And I sincerely thank you just for giving us a hearing.
Thank you very much. Ma'am.
I'm Rita Radry. I coordinate the programs that are offered by Frontier Learning. We select our programs based on the needs of our schools and communities. As you will remember, we serve the students in Gillam, Wheeler, and Sherman counties. There are very few students, but their needs are the same as any other student in the state or throughout the United States as far as that goes. We serve our elementary students with the elementary Spanish through Portland Public Schools, the Ola Ola program. We copy the tapes and distribute those to schools throughout Oregon. Currently, there are over 1,700 students participating in this program this year. Our secondary programs are our professional technical programs in the area of health services, business, information technology, and natural resources. Those are approved PT programs taught with the interactive video. And, of course, our main strength is the interaction with the teacher, being with those students weekly or no less than every 2 weeks. Our adult classes are based on the needs of the communities, but mainly in EMTs, CNA, first responder, computer classes, and, of course, teacher education to help those teachers in our schools through a partnership with Eastern Oregon. All of these are done with the VTEL or interactive video system. I'd like to give you just a quick synopsis of what a secondary class might look like. If I am the teacher teaching natural resources, I might be in Mitchell today through the VTEL teaching to students in Arlington, Condon, Fossil, Spray, and Morrill. Labs are done with facilitators in the schools, so the facilitators are an extremely important part of this program also. Tomorrow I may go to Arlington and teach to all six of the schools from
30 seconds.
Thank you. From there. But the main difference between our program and others is that they do get to see that teacher and interact. We also our field trips and some of our labs are with all participating schools together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls David Campbell. And behind Mr. Campbell, a panel of Pat Fedor, Heidi Schack, Turi and Carrie Hoagland, Maureen Casey, and Dana Skady. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Campbell. I'm a superintendent at Clackamas Education Service District. And I would have to tell you that I have very mixed feelings right now because we operate out of Clackamas ESD, Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Programs that serve some of the folks that you've already listened to. And so I'm emotionally kind of torn this morning because what I'm here to do is talk about the Oregon Public Education Network, more commonly referred to as OPEN. I will be brief. I want to just make a couple of comments that follow up on testimony you heard last week from Doug Costi of the Department of Ed. That is that in 1995, when we were challenged by then-State Superintendent Norma Paulus to create OPEN, there were about 120 schools out of the 1,250 in Oregon that had access to the Internet. The way we've been able to be successful is that we form partnerships. We have worked with the Department of Education, Department of Administrative Services, and Higher Education to create a network that, in fact, does now connect every school in Oregon, both for an intrastate network and to the Internet. Along the way, we were able, working with US West and now Quest, to have a pilot project that that put the first VTEL units in Oregon. That was under Open Access 21. There were 21 of those VTEL units. The Frontier Learning Network grew out of that experience that we had. And then through Senate Bill 622, a VTEL unit was located in every high school in Oregon. Now, as was mentioned just before, some of those units are not being fully utilized yet, and therein lies one of the challenges for Open, and that is to maintain our partnerships, continue to develop an infrastructure that can support the VTEL systems, the data delivery systems, as well as the TESA and other kinds of applications, video streaming, those kinds of things. Our challenge for the future is to create access, equal access, to those systems for all students in Oregon. Back when we began to initiate Open, we had a compelling belief that drove us, and that was that any student who did not have access to this technology would be more disadvantaged than they ever have been through economic means. We believe that's still true today, only now the new challenge is to provide the access to the online courses, the VTEL courses, and all of the other applications that are now available to us. So our challenge is to maintain the network, continue to work with our partners, and provide these opportunities for all of the young people in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pat Bedore. I'm superintendent of Greater Albany Public Schools, and I'm here today with a panel that represents a parent, a student, and other educational administrators to share with you some perspectives on regional programs. While today's testimony that we've heard has been emotional, and I don't know how you stayed dry-eyed, I didn't, but I'm here today as a pragmatist and an advocate for efficiency with public dollars. I represent 12 districts in my region, the Lynn, Benton, Lincoln region, and more broadly, large and small districts throughout the state of Oregon. The districts in my area range in size from 181 students in LC to 8,217 students in my own district. Together, our 12 districts educate 33,350 students, 4,200 of which are in special education. Of those, 525 receive regional special education services in the area of vision, hearing, severe orthopedic, and autism. From my perspective as a superintendent, regional programs provide an efficient, cost-effective service to students with low-incidence, high-cost special education needs. What does this mean for me? It means that whether I'm superintendent in Philomath or Lincoln County, the students in my district that require specialized instruction, such as Braille, sign language, orientation and mobility, hearing aid or language instruction, or adaptations to classrooms for severe orthopedic needs, will get those services. It means that if I have one hearing-impaired student that moves into my district tomorrow that requires specialized services, I can provide those services through the regional programs and the ESD. It means that no child gets left behind in our districts. I'm asking you today to fully support regional programs. When funds to those programs are reduced, there's a direct fiscal impact on local school districts because the services must be required. I mean, the services are required and must be provided by the school districts, even if it's not provided through regional programs. School districts will likely pay considerably more for those services than it costs to run through regional programs because, as we heard earlier, I might only need a very part-time teacher to provide a specialized service, and I can't find that by myself. I can find a teacher to do that through the regional programs.
30 seconds.
Thank you. I want to mention the shared equipment libraries, and I also want to mention that if we don't provide services adequately, we face lengthy due process that costs money. In my district, we're looking at cutting 33 classroom teachers just for next year, and I'm one of the districts this year that's asking for a local option. We're being challenged to spend our dollars wisely and be as efficient as possible. While we make massive cuts, we need you to come alongside us and as we've asked our community, and the importance of this can't be overstated. I thank you for your time, and I'd like to thank the interpreters today. I'm really impressed with their service. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ma'am.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dana Stady. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. I have a low vision daughter who has been in the regional vision program both in the Medford and Portland markets for 17 years. My daughter lost her vision at age 6 months due to a DPT shot. She's been mainstreamed into the public school system since kindergarten, is currently a sophomore honor student, and her goal is to go to college and become an elementary school teacher. The educational services that we have received have allowed my daughter to become a confident and independent student. They have provided or instructed her in areas of familiarizing her to her school environment, Braille, computer technology, utilizing a monocular for mobility, utilizing a CCTV to enhance her reading skills, a four-way recorder for auditory learning skills, and providing enlarged textbooks and worksheets to enhance her studies. They have assisted her in her public school teachers on her abilities and her limitations. They help with testing adaptations, schoolroom, seating and lighting adaptations, her equipment needs, and her need for enlarged worksheets, tests, and books. The regional program provides assistance to the teachers by enlarging her materials and her books in advance. The regional program has provided extensive mobility services, educating and assisting her in exploring transit systems, community services, public and shopping facilities, handling currency in public, utilizing maps, landmarks to assist her in getting around her community. They provided us with a wealth of resources. One in particular, they provide us with resource for grants, so we were able to have a visually enhanced computer built with funding. They've assisted us in many sports, living, and recreational programs which develop fine motor skills, social skills, and living skills for many of these kids. My daughter has participated in numerous programs such as snow camps, cross-country, gymnastics, swimming programs, downhill skiing for the blind, and goal ball tournaments, all which were sponsored by the regional program. Regional program has also been a liaison for the School for the Blind, and she's participated in numerous camps over the years. She'll be attending a SWEAT program this summer, which is a 7-week work program where they will provide her with a job. She'll learn to use the transit system, and for 7 weeks we'll go back and forth in learning and having work experience. They've been instrumental in providing transition from going from elementary to middle school and high school. Thank you. And one last thing I want to, my feeling about this is I would like to ask you a simple question. Is it fiscally responsible to reduce the regional services or other services like we've heard today to these kids and benefit from short-term cuts, knowing that in the long run, if these kids do not have these kind of services, they will need long-term care and be uneducated? Or does it make more sense?
You see the number of people that are waiting to speak. Please.
Okay. I'm about 5 seconds. Or do we provide the necessary budget today to allow them to become independent adults, working adults in the future? I appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The Hoglands. If you've concluded your testimony, we need to get these folks in front of microphones, so if you possibly could. Thank you. Please proceed.
Hi, my name is Kari Hoagland, and I'm a sophomore at Hill High School. I enjoy reading online, chatting with my friends, and going to group activities with friends. I'm active in sports also. I am currently on the varsity golf team. I was born deaf. My parents found out that I was deaf when I was 15 months old. I joined the Northwest Regional Program when I was 10. The first year the program was established. but I have received services from Columbia Regional Program before that. The regional programs provide skilled teachers who know sign language and teach us the same way as hearing teachers do. Well, almost. Sometimes the interpreters explain more clearly things when we don't get it. The interpreters have the skills to sign both ASL and English. Regional programs allow me to go to school with other deaf kids and have access to mainstream classes. If I wasn't in this program, my communication skills and education level would be much lower. Do you know anyone who is in a special education program? How do you think they feel about cutting the budget more because of limited resources? I would like to see this program continue because I want the younger kids to have the same opportunities to experience the things that I have. I want their educational level to improve as they get older. In the future, I hope to go to college, to a four-year university, and major in foods or world history. My dream is to travel the world and see many different places. I hope I will get a scholarship for college. I have 2 years left of high school. This program will help me decide which college fits me best and will help find scholarships for me to go to college. Thank you for letting me have the opportunity to speak to you all, and please continue to fund the regional programs.
Thank you. Ma'am. That's my daughter, and I'm very, very proud of her today. Madam Chairwoman, thank you for allowing me to speak right after her. My name is Turi Hoagland. I am the mother of a deaf child. We live in the Beaverton School District, but my daughter, Kari, received services administered by the Northwest Low Incidence Regional Program, Northwest Regional ESD, located within the Hillsboro School District. I am here to plead for maintenance of funding from grant and aid for my daughter's services rather than shifting the entire cost to my local school district. Under the current model of regional programs, which include students from many districts, both rural and urban, we can continue to serve students in the least restrictive setting in a cost-effective manner. We are able to serve more students for far less money than if services were provided in her home school, as stated in the Special Education Legislative Task Force report of October 2002. The other advantages of maintaining funding are being with deaf peers socially for language development. They are tracked with hearing peers from elementary through high school. The American Sign Language Program at Hill High, which allows these students to become part of the school community, mainstream opportunities, staff with experience of having interpreters in their classrooms, and a very supportive administration. Given this support, Kari and others like her will have the necessary tools to go to college, hold down a job, and ultimately become taxpayers. The Northwest Regional ESD has been very fiscally responsible with the funding they have received. Most of the monies are going to direct service to students. Our administrative costs are so lean, our administrators, both of them, often end up in the classroom teaching or interpreting as substitutes in addition to their other responsibilities. I am continually amazed at what the Northwest Regional ESD has been able to do with such limited resources. My daughter and her peers are thriving at Hill High. In addition to academics, we currently have 6 of the 8 deaf students participating in spring sports as well as club activities. We must continue to fund these programs at a high enough level to maintain federal matching dollars. We have an obligation to this generation and the next generation to become productive, contributing members of society. 30 seconds.
If we don't pay now in school funding, the cost will likely be higher. Higher costs for local school districts, students, the community, and the state. What will be the ultimate cost? Prisons, mental health, teen moms and welfare? This plea is not only for my daughter, but for those who will be following her. And please fund public education now.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, My name is Heidi Schock, and I am Director of Special Services for Silver Falls School District. Mine is a moderately sized district comprised of approximately 260 square miles and 3,600 students. Over the past 2 years, considering current year and projections for next year, my district is experiencing a need to cut $2 million out of our local general education budget. Those number of cuts signify numbers of teachers, multiple programs, a loss of an alternative program, and much, much more. Currently, in my district, 41 school-age students are served by regional services. The total number of regional support dollars for these services and the necessary equipment for the children equals approximately $115,000, going to 26 students with autism, 6 with vision impairments, 3 who are severely orthopedically impaired, and 6 with hearing impairments, 4 of whom have costly interpreters. This amount does not include those regional services provided the children birth to age 4 that reside in my district. If my district were to be required to assume this $115,000, it would be an additional financial burden at a time when severe cuts are already being made. Since the services currently provided by regional services are mandatory, my district would have no alternative but to assume the responsibility for providing them at a cost in excess of the current $115,000. As you have heard, recruitment of low-incident specialists is already a difficult task, even for full-time positions, with a state and nationwide search being necessary. Because my district's need for highly trained specialists to deliver the required services would be less than full-time, my district would be faced with two expensive options: recruiting for more contract time than was actually needed, or paying these specialists far more per hour than the customary rate as an incentive for them to be working part-time. In either case, the current amount spent would be inadequate to cover the cost of staff to provide the same level of services. As a result, my district would be in legal jeopardy for failure to provide those mandated services.
30 seconds, ma'am.
In addition to the regional approach for adequate staffing, you've heard about the equipment banks that are available. The economy of scale realized through the regional concept allows districts who have students move in and have sudden equipment needs to be able to use that equipment without having to purchase them and then have equipment sit unused for long periods of time. We cannot provide these high-cost services without substantial impact on every student in the district. The additional burden beyond the $2 million already cut from my district's budget would be impossible for us to bear. Dollars for regional services have suffered a steady decline over the last decade, while the number of eligible students has increased dramatically. In order for Oregon to maintain a successful education system for all of its students, it is imperative that adequate funding be allocated to maintain regional services as a proven and cost-effective means of providing costly, low-incident services.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maureen Casey, and I'm the Deputy Superintendent at Willamette Education Service District. We orchestrated this panel of people to give you a panoramic view of regional services from a variety of different perspectives, and I think they've done an exceptional job of personalizing the impact and the importance of those services. We've got a map coming up before you that illustrates the 8 regional programs across the state, and I'm here as a contractor to tell you that the regional programs represent the strongest, most efficient special education partnership in the state of Oregon. The partnerships between the State Department of Education, local school districts, and ESDs. The State Department contracts with the 7 ESDs in Portland Public School that you see on the map. We cover all 198 districts in the state. There are approximately 71,000 students eligible in the system for special education. Out of those 71,000, you're talking about 6,000 that have low incident, high need, high-cost disabilities. That's what regional programs were established for. We cross over county lines. We cross over school district lines. And it's interesting that the regional story began 22 years ago before the 1981 Legislative Assembly, who was struggling in the midst of an economic crisis to come up with some kind of a safety net for districts to offset excess costs for students with high-need disabilities. There were three major issues then, and you know what? 22 years later, they're the same issues. Highly qualified staff that are very specialized in order to provide the services, cost efficiencies, and equity of services, no matter where you live in Oregon and without regard to the size of your district. 22 years later, we just finished an interim legislative task force study at your request on special education. Hearings were held across the state. The single most frequent and strongest testimony was in support of local regional programs, the service delivery model. 22 years, districts have not come up with a more cost-effective way to provide the services. Okay, so let's go back. Let's take zero-based budgeting scenario. So let's say we didn't have a regional service delivery model in front of us right now, and we had to set up a system to provide services to this particular group of students. How would we do that in the most efficient way in terms of the staffing and the resources? It would be to turn around and put together some kind of regionalized structure. A compelling example is this is a high school history book. And what's coming before you right now is the Braille version of this history book. It costs $536 to Braille. We have an algebra book, one book, $3,600 to Braille. Regional programs maintain a statewide Braille production center that provides textbooks for every single district in the state. How could a district pay $6,000, $3,000 for one book? So we would urge you to not do whatever you can possibly do to not put the program back to a point where it could not be rebuilt, because it's the model on top of everything else you've heard today that is serving Oregon and its districts well. Thank you.
Sir, before we hear your testimony, on deck will be Deborah Amo, Mary Williams, and Shannon Springer. Please proceed.
Thank you for letting me go out of turn. For the record, Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Peter Hanley. I'm here today with my son, Juan. Juan, would you like to say hello?
No.
Okay, thank you. For obvious reasons, I will be brief. I've handed out written testimony, which explains my situation and Juan's. Juan suffered seizure disorder. He had surgery a couple years ago, which has brought the seizures under control, but he's seriously delayed as far as speech, fine motor skills, and physical skills. Early intervention has helped Juan to progress to a state now where he's catching up. And it would be a shame for this program to suffer any more budget cuts. It's been reduced by about 40% over the last 6 years, and if we reduce it anymore, I'm afraid that we're really not going to be doing much. He needed, according to his neurosurgeon, neurologist, and pediatric specialist, a minimum of 9 hours a week in speech, occupational, and physical therapy. He's getting four. We get a couple through our private plan, but private plans are cutting back now to a certain number of visits as well. So we're really counting on the early intervention program to help us. And I want to thank you for allowing me to butt in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Deborah Amo, Mary Williams, and Shannon Springer. And on deck, right a minute here, is Jody Williams, and a panel of Donna Schnichter, Michael Eichmann, Yvonne Roberts, and Cynthia Chiampi, I believe, or Clampy. Please proceed.
My name is Shannon Springer, and I'm from Prairie City, Oregon. And this is my daughter, Emily, and she has been hearing impaired since birth. And I'm not here to talk about the nuts and bolts of a program. Just from a parent's perspective, We live in a pretty remote rural area, and the services that we receive through the early intervention program are, it sounds like, kind of minimal compared to what some of the folks in other parts of the state get. Emily receives an hour of time with the hearing specialist once a week. And while it doesn't sound like much, she spends an awful lot of time with the family, the child care provider, the other kids in child care, helping us all learn what we can do to help enhance Emily's language and listening and speech. And without that kind of education and support for our family, I don't think Emily would be speaking as much as she is today. And she was also, just for your information and to know that you've done a good thing, she was identified by the newborn hearing screening. And
okay. I'm Debbie Amell. I am from Washington State. I'm here in support of my daughter, Jody Williams, who has her son in the school for the Oregon School for the Blind. Speaking a little loud here, sorry. I'm not very good at this, so bear with me. I am all three of my children currently have learning disabilities and have been supported by Washington State services, and we've had an extremely difficult time in getting those services there. My grandson here in Oregon, with the help of many people, was able to put him over at the school for the blind. And without that, his success and his future, and many of those children that are there, would have a very hard time. He now is becoming very independent. He is 11 years old. The services there are very much required for him to succeed, and many other children. So I ask you to please bear in mind that these children with all kinds of disabilities are part of our future. We need to support them. We don't want them to be put away in places eventually where they shouldn't be, because we can teach them. We, as members of the United States, people, citizens, can all help these children as long as we all work together and we remember that they are part of our future.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mary Williams, and I'm from Bend, and I am the other grandparent of the little gentleman that goes to the school for the blind. And in watching him grow from a young child, he was pretty well adjusted, and once he didn't know that he was much different from anyone else until at the time it was to go to school and at time to be integrated into a society that doesn't always take allowances for our challenged children. Academically, he did fairly well. The school system where we come from over in Bend, Oregon, is good. Socially, he was being stifled. There was no social activities. He wasn't invited to parties. It was very difficult for him. And living very close to the school, there were many occasions when I would see him out on the playground by himself, and also other children, which is normal for children to push him and shove him. Fortunately for us, he has been attending the Oregon School for the Blind. He has become so independent. It's almost like viewing a little college gentleman living in a dorm at 11 years old. He helps out because, fortunately enough, he can see the difference between light and dark, so he can be of assistance to others. The fundamental basic needs, these people over there stress, they work diligently, that these children are going to be independent, functioning human beings that are able to take care of themselves in our society. And I want everyone to please bear in mind, when you are making the difficult decisions, that we really need to take care of these folks. Thank you.
Sorry, this is really emotional for me. It's the first time I've ever done anything like this. My son is Dalton Williams.
For the record, could you state your name?
I'm Jody Williams.
Thank you.
And without the School for the Blind, my son would not be where he's at today. They do offer many, many services for them.
they are involved in many field trips that aren't just a fun build fund field trip. They learn many things from the field trips, and I've tried to be involved as much as possible that I can. We do live a far distance away, so it is difficult at times. And the School for the Blind with the dorm and the counselors and the teachers and the staff that is there is like a family away from home for him. Without the School for the Blind, I don't know where I would be today. Because as you can see, it's very difficult for me now. And without that, my son nor his family would be where they are with him today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll call forward a panel of Donna Schnichter, Michael Eichmann, Yvonne Roberts, and Cynthia Clampy or Campy. And after that, we will have... This will conclude all of the people that I have signed up that are have indicated that they live more than 100 miles away. After this panel is finished, I will call forward Helena Verdine, Mike Babcock, and Ruth Estrada. Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Counsel representing the Oregon Head Start Association. Today we have four individuals that we want to give you a brief presentation about Head Start, emphasizing standards, performance measurements, and outcomes. As you know, during special sessions, Head Start program was reduced, as were many, many programs throughout the state, from about $61.9 to about $55 million. The governor has further reduced that to about $53 million for this biennium. We were concerned because we think there was somewhat of a disproportionate share that was lost in Head Start in terms of looking at some other areas. But having said that, we know that there is strong support within the body and on both sides of the aisle for this program, and we want to emphasize today, again, outcomes, performance measurements, and standards, and then tell you a few stories about the success of Head Start. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mike.
Please proceed. Chairperson Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Donna Schnitker, and I'm a Head Start director from Harnett County and also the chairperson of the Legislative Committee for the Head Start Association in Oregon. And my part of the presentation today is I pass out to you a report. I want to give you a little bit of background before I talk about the report specifically. Last session, we presented some research from the FACES, F-A-C-E-S program, which is a national research project from the Federal Head Start program, and with the idea that we needed to look at some way of presenting to you this session some specific data that came from Oregon only. And as part of the performance requirements that we have, we must assess children in the classroom three times a year. And then we have to use that information to plan how to present information to children so they grow in the areas where the class in itself or the individual children are not succeeding. And we use a variety of programs, one of which is Galileo. And Galileo is an online program that the National Head Start Association is using to look at child outcomes. There are 13 indicators that the federal performance standards require that we monitor, and we have to do it three times a year. Galileo report that you have in front of you gives you just two of the eight domains that we have to assess, and I gave you different variety of ways of looking at it. The first one shows you in graph form children that were assessed in October and then again assessed in February. And so, but the results I can pull up because it's online any day of the week or the year and give you the most current data that's available on children. And sometimes people have difficulty reading the graph, so let me explain it to you briefly. It shows that where children are at an October 31st beginning means that they're at the very elementary level of the assessment process. The intermediate shows you they are moving forward out of the beginning into the intermediate, and the advanced shows that they are achieving many of the goals on the assessment tool. Behind that, I've given you what the tool looks like that the graph supports, and it shows the percentage of children that have learned the goal, the percentage of children that are ready now,
the children that will be ready soon and ready later. And this is what the teacher uses to decide how they're going to lesson plan for their classes. At the very back of that, I've also given you the eight domains that we assess, and it shows you, this is a normed reference scale, so it shows you the percentile placement that the children are for these various tools.
Thank you. I imagine you already have this figured out what order you want to go in, so please just proceed.
Great. Well, yes, Madam Chair, Representative Morgan and honorable committee members, I want to thank you for the time to speak. My name is Michael Eichmann, and I'm the Executive Director of Head Start of Yamhill County, and here today representing my colleagues at the Oregon Head Start Association. Today my testimony is going to address the Oregon pre-kindergarten performance standards. The Head Start performance standards are a blueprint for our success. Seldom will you hear programs sing the praises of standards, and my colleagues, that's exactly what they've asked me to come here today to express to you, is that they are a good thing for Head Start. The performance standards are the core of our program's accomplishments over the years, and they are a formula that guides each program through the steps of delivering comprehensive services. The basic ingredients in the Head Start formula haven't changed over time, and the Head Start performance standards cover the fundamental needs of healthy family development. Children's health and safety standards are spelled out. Basic medical exams, immunization, and dental screenings are outlined with specific timelines and the follow-up that's necessary. Guidance in early childhood education and development are a large part of the program standards, and they lay out the education approach that stimulates curiosity and an eagerness to learn. Head Start is, by the way, the largest single provider of services to children with disabilities in the state of Oregon. Our standards include nutrition, food safety, and social education regarding what our cultural expectations would be for shared eating experiences. Having just come from Denmark last week and looking at child development centers there, it's interesting to look at those things in different parts of the world. We look at children's emotional health and mental needs, and they're profiled in these standards. Significant guidance is outlined regarding parents and extended family members' involvement in the program and the nature of our community partnerships. The transition expectations for children leaving to public school are also outlined. And in the program design and management areas, the standards and structures of program governance outline parents and the shared governance structure that we have. Parents learn the skills of a representative democracy, and they get more invested in their children's education. The human resources and management systems, the facilities and equipment round out the overall look at what those performance standards are. And when you couple that with ongoing monitoring, compassionate and dedicated staff, you have what has really been, over time, the most successful large-scale early childhood program in the world. These standards are a part of what you see in Oregon State statutes, in the revised statutes, and they were adopted more than a decade ago. And I didn't give them to you. I gave you a publication there that it sort of outlines the I guess you'd say, the compassionate partnership. But I'd like to end by saying that really in the greatest nation in the world and one of the greatest states in this nation, that I believe that for our own mutual security, that we need more than words regarding leaving no child behind. We need a social contract and a state contract and a national contract that are going to fund these programs for Oregonians in the future. Head Start guidelines mandate that we serve the neediest of the needy and the lowest of the low income. These children's lives march on, and they can't wait for another legislative session to have these programs funded. They'll be entering school here shortly, and they need high-quality school experiences.
Sir, if you could please conclude your comments.
Sure. There isn't a better program out there, and there isn't a program that serves more needy or special need kids. Thanks.
Thank you.
I sincerely thank you for your time, and we appreciate your consideration.
Thank you.
Actually, Mr. Buttrick, is going to go next.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, Madam Chair. I was reflecting. Richard Buttrick. I work for Associated Oregon Industries.
Thank you very much.
I was reflecting in the hall, waiting for my opportunity for my 2 minutes of fame here, Madam, to reflect on how many times I've been before you or your predecessors, and it's 8 times, equaling 16 years, and I have really nothing more to add to what I have added in the past 16 years as it relates to Head Start. I have a modest credentials. I did serve for 5 years as chairman of the business community connected to the National Head Start Association. And, of course, as you know, the president of the National Head Start Association is an Oregonian. His name is Ronnie Herndon, and he's been president for 10 years, elected five times for two-year terms. I think that the reason the business community is so interested in Head Start and has been interested in it is because it is so successful. It is recognized by the federal government as being one of the most successful programs of its type or any type in the country, as has been reflected here a minute ago. Due to recent census changes, the numbers have varied. For example, 2 years ago, 55%, as I understand it, of the babies eligible were covered by Head Start. Then it dropped down to about 48%, and the new census data has it eligible children are covered up to 60%. But that's still four kids out of 10 that are eligible that aren't in the program. The goals that the state of Oregon set about 10 years ago was that 5 years ago, 100% of eligible children would be covered, and so we're only at best at 60%. Another area that I think is worth noting is the fact that there's enormous parental involvement in the teaching program at Head Start. Then it comes to money. And I leave you with one little anecdote that I will repeat that came from the Superintendent of Public Instruction about 5 or 6 years ago, Norma Paulus. And she was asked by one of your predecessors, perhaps it was Senator Gordley, I don't remember exactly. Anyway, she was asked, well, how are we going to pay for this? Because we do have a problem.
30 seconds, sir.
Her answer was, if I had a choice between canceling the 12th grade and making all the kids eligible for Head Start, being in Head Start, I'd choose Head Start. And that was an interesting, thoughtful note, one I'd never heard before. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair Morgan and members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Champi, Italian. I am a divorced mother of three children, and I am a Head Start parent and have been for the last 2 years. This year, I have had the opportunity to serve on the Budget Committee and Policy Council. On Policy Council, I serve on panel as treasurer. At the Budget Committee, we would discuss the budget, spending ideas, as well as saving ideas. I would then take these ideas to Policy Council, which is made up of other parents in Head Start. Policy Council would then vote on any decisions needing to be made. Head Start policy and procedures are discussed at Policy Council and voted on. Parents have an important say in Head Start. I am proud to be a Head Start parent. Head Start is more than a preschool. It is a parent support and community support program. My daughter has grown and learned so much in Head Start. Last year, she couldn't even hold a pencil correctly. This year, she can write her first and last name, count to 20, and write and identify 20 letters in the alphabet. Head Start family educators and teachers help me to learn more effective ways to teach my daughter skills she will need in kindergarten, as well as parenting skills and ideas to better deal with behavior and social behavior issues with my daughter. It has been amazing to see the improvements in the last 2 years. When I lost my job in January, my family educator from Head Start had a meeting with me to make sure I knew the resources available to me and my family. In part because of her, I was able to stay in my home. In our Head Start building, we have a parent room, which doubles as a mini food bank, clothing bank, and goods exchange for things like soap, shampoo, laundry detergent, and tissue paper. If you have a need, you can go to the cupboard and take what you need, and then you can replace it, the items, with a new one when you're able. People have even brought in things like used high chairs and car seats, and if you needed these items, you can just have it. Head Start is a great asset to low-income parents. I have great pride in my participation with Head Start and great pride in my daughter's growth in Head Start. I will always be grateful for the Head Start program. As you can tell, there are a lot of faces in the Head Start program, and 4 minutes isn't nearly enough time to tell you what Head Start means to me and my family. Thank you for the opportunity and your time to share my story, and thank you for the support of Head Start.
Thank you very much. Ma'am.
I'm just going to scoogie this over if that's okay. Madam Chairwoman and honorable committee members, thank you so much for hearing us and hearing about Head Start. I was asked to come here. My name is Yvonne Roberts, for the record. I was asked to come here to give you a parent's perspective, and I can actually give you a parent and a staff's perspective. I was a parent 12 years ago. My son's now in the 10th grade. I now run the fiscal and HR office in my Head Start program back in McMinnville, Oregon. I want to kind of give you a different perspective, and I'll do this very quickly, of what happened back then, where I was back then and where I am now. Something very close to you, back then, I didn't vote. I'm ashamed to say that, but I did not vote. I didn't know what a voter registration was. I'd never seen a ballot. I vote now, and I vote very passionately. My husband also. So this goes for two of us. Economically wise, 12 years ago, I was on welfare. Right now, I'm paying taxes. I think they're catching up on me. But 12 years ago, I was on welfare. Right now, I feel like I'm a productive citizen. This all has to do with Head Start. 12 years ago, I rented my home. Right now, I own my home. Let's go on to health-wise. 12 years ago, I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day. 23 years later, I quit. My husband also. 12 years ago, I weighed over 300 pounds. I'm now a little lower than that, thank God. But health-wise, all these things come from Head Start. I could not be the person I am today without Head Start, honestly. Here's another one, self-esteem. 12 years ago, you would not have seen me here. You would not have seen me here. Today, I'm the biggest advocate for Head Start, the biggest. Let me tell you just a few words about my awesome son. He's in 12th grade or 10th grade right now, but he has a college-level reading skill. He's awesome. He has a goal to have a degree in political science. That's his goal. My goal is that my Head Start child one day will be sitting up there with you. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. A great panel. Wonderful testimony. Chair calls Helena Verdun, Mike Babcock, and Ruth Estrada. And on deck is Shannon Noble, Nathan Spice, and Damian Wolfgram. Please begin.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Helena Verdine, and I am a part of the McMinnville FFA chapter. I have been a member for 3 years. I'm a junior in high school now. I gave a speech like this to my district also because they were going to cut my advisor's stipend. We haven't heard the verdict yet. FFA has done so many things for me in these 3 years. My freshman year, I was elected as reporter. I also got to go to National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky. That was a blast. There were hundreds and hundreds of FFA members from all over the nation. We congregated in one location, having one thing in common, agricultural education. My sophomore year, my team in environmental sciences won first at state. We brought home, we got to compete in nationals. We brought home 16th in the nation and the rookie team award, beating out Texas. FFA has made all those things possible. Yesterday, we had an officer elections for next school year. I always voted as vice president. Yesterday, I also learned the FFA, along with other leadership organizations, were going to be cut. I was, and still am, saddened by this news. Without leadership, we would not have people like John F. Kennedy or Jimmy Carter, who, by the way, was an FFA member. Without leadership, nothing would happen. And without leadership and support of my advisor, I would not be here this morning to talk in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mike Babcock.
Yes. My name is Mike Babcock. I'm 15 years old, and I attend South High School. I've been attending South High School for South School Districts for 3 years now. And since I've been attending South Schools, I've been getting A's and B grades. My family's moved around a lot, and we've stayed in Oregon. My family's moved around a lot, but something that I have found that in all the different schools that I've been in is I've had the Oregon Regional the Oregon Regional Program. This program has given me instructions in Braille reading, writing, traveling with my cane, working with assistive technology, providing materials, adapted materials for me. These services have gotten me ready for high school, and I do thank the state of Oregon for giving these services to me in the past. Now, if I lose the services, I will not have the ability to have them help me with my college, getting ready for college. I'm here today to try and keep the services of the Oregon Regional Program for the visually impaired. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Estrada.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Ruth Estrada, and I'm here from McMinnville. I'm here today as a parent, FFA volunteer, and as a member of the agriculture and nursery industry, and also as a taxpayer. Please look around the room. Really look at the young people here today. Children are our futures, an often used and overused phrase, but here it is true. They are the future leaders who will provide health care, business leadership, and provide food, shelter, and a better quality of life for all they come in contact with. These are also the people who will provide for us as we grow older. Our future is literally in their hands. The Student Leadership Development Center must continue to exist. I am here to comment specifically on FFA. In our school district, it has been said that leadership skills and the specifics involved in FFA can be learned in the classroom. This is not so. As budgets are cut, classroom size increases, and teachers have less time for anything except paperwork. Oregon is still very much an agricultural state. In my profession, the nursery industry brings in over $650 million in farm gate sales, provides well over 35,000 jobs statewide, and contributes to the quality of life in Oregon by building and promoting such places as the Oregon Garden in Silverton. The professionals who work in this continually growing industry do not just suddenly develop an interest in agriculture when they arrive at college. The motivation to work in all areas of agriculture starts much earlier. To sustain this very important facet of Oregon's economy, we need to pass Bill 5015 to support our students, our future. Just one last comment. Outside this building, as previously mentioned, are words that start with a free state and end with the sharing of benefits justly apportioned. The students here are getting ready to go into college. They're facing careers. They're the folks who are going to provide for those of us in the baby boom era who are looking at retirement, hopefully, and also all of the young children who you've seen here today. Please help us in getting these bills and funds passed. Thank you
very much. Chair calls Nathan Stice, Damian Wolfgram, and Shannon Noble. And the next panel will be Lacey McReynolds, Mike Folan, and Anna Shepherd.
I think Shannon came up already. I'm not sure if she's from Prairie City. She had a different last name.
So is she where?
She already testified.
Oh, she already testified?
Yeah.
Okay. The Nathaniel Slice, Damian Wolfgram are not available. Chair calls Lacey McReynolds, Mike Folan, and Anna Shepherd. And on deck is Trevor Palin and Jason Marshall and S. Yeah, we'll take Trevor Palin and Jason Marshall. Please proceed.
Hi, I'm Anna Shepherd. I'm from the North Clackamas FFA chapter, and I'm currently the state Oregon FFA state secretary. I'm a city girl, and my friends are city kids. I live less than a mile from Clackamas Town Center. I am within walking distance of food, clothing stores, and entertainment. However, I've always known that something was missing. There has to be more in life than the finished product. My inquiring mind needed to know what that was. As a shy, naive, and unsure freshman, I went against the norm and signed up for an agricultural science class. Little did I know, I was also joining the largest student leadership organization in North America, 460,000 members strong. Here's how my world began to change. My first experience as an FFA member was showing a market lamb at County Fair. At first, I was unsure of myself. It was hard, but I had fun. This led to public speaking. At first, I was unsure of myself again. It was hard, but it changed my life, as I was awarded first runner-up in the National Prepared Public Speaking event in Louisville, Kentucky last fall. This branched my agriculture in the classroom teaching experience. At the beginning, I was unsure of myself. It was hard, but it allowed me to make a difference in the lives of 50 fifth graders by teaching them about agriculture and how it impacts their lives every day. It also became my senior project, my CAM endorsement, and satisfied my career-related learning experiences requirements. This ultimately led to my leadership experiences. In all offices I've held, I have felt unsure at the beginning. They've been hard, but now I have an opportunity as a new state officer to impact the lives of 4,500 FFA members in Oregon. While I'll be able to share with them about leadership opportunities, their advisors, business and industry people will be able to help them realize their potential in careers such as teaching, veterinary medicine, business, sales, journalism, politics, and law, just to name a few. Now I am more than a city girl, and I have my agriculture education to thank for that. Thank you.
Great testimony.
Hi, my name is Lacey McReynolds. I'm also from the North Clackamas FFA, and I'm a senior at Clackamas High School. Now, I grew up in a more rural area, and I knew that I had a love for animals and that I also had a love for speaking. However, when I got into high school, I realized that there weren't many classes that could really challenge me and my outgoing ability. My second year in high school, I got into the FFA, and I couldn't stop. I did so many activities. I tried every single competition and every single speaking event possible. I started by showing a market lamb, moved on to having three species at one fair, and now I've done my senior project, which started out as a beef project. I had two market steers, and I raised them to improve the flavor, the palatability, and create a more nutritional product for my consumers. I've taken this project on to a higher level, competing at state, continuing on next year at nationals, and hopefully I will be able to continue this project through college. As a high school student, I was competing a college-level project and now have the ability to address those professors who are interested in my project and who would like me to continue on. Through the FFA and with this program, I have had the ability to meet many new outstanding people who are going to make a real difference for me when I'm choosing my career path. They've offered me the opportunity to speak to college professors, industry men, and we now have the support of other local businesses that are looking for future prospects out of our students. As a Green Hand member, our first year, I had the ability to go to a business and address them as a student. And without the FFA, I wouldn't have had that courage and that opportunity to step forward and talk to these businesses. Now we have support from Les Schwab, Lumbermans, larger businesses like the Grange and the American Beef Association. But one of the things that I'd like to stress to you is that by putting funding back in for these student leadership centers, programs like the FFA, DECA, OFAC can continue on, and that these students, these typical high school students, will have that opportunity to step above and beyond the standards that are given at the high school level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm just going to be real quick.
Could you state your name, please?
Sorry. My name is Mike Folan. I passed out an economic impact study that was done at Crater High School, which is in the Central Point area. If you please would turn to the final page in the packet. I'd like to point out number 4, the total economic impact of the agricultural science and technology program on the community. That one high school and one FFA program impacted the community and put $500,000, $500,000, back into the community. That is through programs like the livestock sales, through agricultural teacher salaries. Without the Student Leadership Development Center and state leadership, these programs would not be able to take that money and return it back into the communities. The majority of this money went directly through students, which means that these students were able to raise this money in a format where they could then return it back to the community. It's many times mentioned that FFA programs, AOFC, FCCLA, FBLA, all other professional technical student organizations have a social and educational purpose in our schools, but many times it's passed over that they also have an economic impact on our communities and are also very important in maintaining that collaboration between students and local businesses that will ultimately lead to career success. I just wanted to bring this to your attention, and thank you for allowing me to speak to you today.
Thank you very much. Outstanding panel. Great testimony. Chair calls Trevor Palin and Jason Marshall from the FBLA program, and up on deck is S. Brooks, Linda Brooks, and Cynthia Freeman and Freeman Payne.
Well, Madam Chair, while they're coming up, I just want to mention I'm a former FFA member myself, so you too can be up here.
Yeah, good comment.
Well, Madam Chairman, there's two of us.
Ah. Thank you very much. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for coming here today. Please begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Trevor Palin, Oregon Future Business Leaders of America State President. I'd first off like to say that I appreciate all of you for being here today, for the tough decisions that you're going to have to make. Because I know whether you, either way you vote for it, you're going to have people not liking your decisions. And I respect that and understand, and think I really appreciate you guys for being up there. Today I represent almost 100 schools in every corner of Oregon that impact 75 communities and 2,500 students. With the six other organizations and the Student Leadership Development Center, we touch every community in the state. I appreciate what you guys do because of the decisions FBLA has made me and our state to make. Recently, we have had to choose programs to cut and to keep to weather the storm of financial trouble. At our state business leadership conference recently, for the following year, we have decided to cut our state officer team nearly in half by reducing, by cutting the positions of secretary treasurer, publicity director, and by redistricting, cutting the district numbers almost in half, saving our state much money. Today and recently, you will have the decision of if you will keep 53 consecutive years of Oregon FBLA or if it will come to an end. But what amazes me is that not since World War II has it totally halted the support, development, and growth for Oregon FBLA. For 53 years, we haven't been cut or had been on cutting blocks like we are today. I could spend the entire day talking to you, and I'm sure some of you might like to listen, but I'm going to keep myself to 3 points. Number one, legislation spends asking $720,000 a biennium and approximately $360,000 a year, of which my organization gets roughly $50,000 a year. This money provides funding that opens the door for students to walk through. But this funding is also matched by students from Oregon FBLA, Future Business Leaders of America, invest in their own future in education by spending $250,000 a year to help do the things in FBLA, which is different from any other organization or any school functions that are limited to people due to like athletics, where they limit people to so many members and they have no fees to pay. FBLA is unlimited and has no boundaries for members. Anyone can join, and anyone has the opportunity to do amazing things. And the rare thing about these students is they want to learn. These are the students who want to learn and who want to be here and are saying this and are asking you to give them the opportunity by paying for our administrators to allow them to give the opportunities and to do things that they are willing to do.
30 seconds.
These organizations, and specifically Oregon FBLA, bring together the most elite student leaders in Oregon. Accounting One state champion Connie Wong from Tualatin, Technology State Champion Mike Horowitz from Sutherland High School. These are a couple of the students, to just name a few. The seven organizations place every student on equal ground, no matter how large or small their high school, and allow them to do truly amazing things and to become tomorrow's leaders, crossing schools' typical boundaries. Now is your chance to invest in the future of this state and this nation. Remember that the leaders are developed today will be running this nation tomorrow. My generation is the future. Believe that, and please make sure that we continue giving funding to the Student Leadership Development Center so they can continue to give students the opportunities, experiences, and training to realize their incredible leadership potential.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members. My name is Jason Marshall, and in order to get more people to speak, I'll just have my testimony end with my written statement.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Chair calls S. Brooks, Linda Brooks, Cynthia, and Freeman Payne. And on deck is Joe Messenger, Reyes Rivera, and Scott Pfaff. That's okay. We can take care of it. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Shemily Brooks. I'm from the Oregon School for the Blind. And the reasons we benefit from the Oregon School for the Blind are: we learn to read Braille books. We learn how to do Braille. By being instructed to do Braille, we learn Braille, and it is very hard for me because I have blindness as well as dyslexia. Most of our students have other disabilities, which make it hard to learn. We also, the ways that we learn to write, we use a variety of electronic note takers, including Braille and Speaks, Braille lights, and computers. And the ways that we learn to write are, we use Braillers, slate and stylus, and also other note takers as well. We also learn living skills so that we can travel independently and live on our own. We also learn orientation and mobility skills so that we can travel on public transportation independently. We also were taught cane skills so that we don't have to depend on others for help. The students of the Oregon School for the Blind would like you to continue funding this program, because without this program, we cannot be as successful members in society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great testimony. Linda Brooks.
I noticed the sun shining out there beautifully today. Thank you for letting me speak on behalf of Oregon School for the Blind. And I'm hoping that sunshine is going to help educate keep our program going, as they well deserve it. My name is Linda Brooks, and I am the parent of three children that attend the School for the Blind, Shamalee being one of them. All three of the girls have multiple disabilities, and therefore they have been in a regular school setting. They have been in ESD classes. They were certainly in early intervention, but because of needing extra time for Braille, extra time for mobility, extra time for living skills, the School of the Blind has been very beneficial to the three of them. They are there from in the morning to learn a lot of hygiene things, dressing skills, feeding skills. During the school for their vocational instruction, their Braille job experiences, technology. And in the evenings, they are there learning how to cook meals and how to plan meals and how to go into the community and be involved in different community aspects that helps them to become more of a typical adult in their future. Shamalee has been blessed. She went to the SWEP program 2 years ago. It'll be 3 years this summer, which is the student work experience program. And because of her disability, she can't travel on transportation safely. So they found a job for her in our community, and she worked for the Molalla Library that summer, and 3 hours a day, which gave her a longer period of time into the rest of the school year, working 3 hours a day, the funding was there for longer. So she continued on Saturdays after school had started. And when the funds ran out for her there, Malala Library hired her as a permanent part-time worker. She's had the job. This will be her second summer. And through the week, working on Saturdays.
30 seconds.
Let's see. And I know that without the help from the School for the Blind and all the people that work with her, that this would not have been a possibility for her, as well as for our other children who are making great progress down there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair and Representative Morgan and committee, thank you very much for your time. On behalf of my husband and myself, I wish to...
For the
yes. My name is Cynthia Payne, and also representing my husband, Freeman Payne. First, let us say thank you for your efforts. Your job is huge and definitely has a lot for consideration. Our son, Marshall, is 15 and the light of our life. He has taught us and the people around us so much about life. Like so many of his peers, there is an innocence about just being, and it is an inspiration to us when we get bogged down in our sometimes mundane day-to-day living. Marshall, by the way, is blind and has multiple disabilities. Marshall's success and triumphs we believe to be largely due to the commitment of the teachers and the staff that he has had over the years. We have been blessed by his being able to attend the Oregon State School for the Blind just blocks from here. Without the presence of the school, it is highly likely that Marshall might very well be in foster care right now because of his high level of needs. He requires 24/7, and though we adore him as as our child, it gets to be a bit much at times. Marshall started receiving services when he was a year old through early intervention, and I can't say enough about that either. Everything we have received as a family for the last 14 years has been nothing but supportive. Without it, I really don't know where we would be today. His successes and strengths mark the successes and strengths of our community. Marshall has attended OSB two different times. The first time was from 96 to 2000. He started attending again last fall. We would have to say one of the biggest accomplishments for Marshall has been being completely independent of his parents. This is an accomplishment simply because of his need for 24/7 care. He has come a very long way, considering that the first doctor that ever saw him stated very matter-of-factly that he would never do anything for himself. If that doctor is still practicing, and I hope he isn't, I would have to say to him, define never and anything. Marshall is doing a lot. He is walking, communicating, though nonverbally, expressing, giving, sharing, and, well, you get the idea.
30 seconds, ma'am.
The individuals who receive special education are a vital part of our community, regardless if they are seen as a financial drain. Without the state schools and special education, we will be chipping away at part of our community.
Thank you very much. Chair calls Joe Messenger, Rias Rivera, and Scott Pfaff. And next up is Glenn Larson, Christy Riechel, or R-I-E-H-L, I believe it is, and Larry Hall.
You should sign to the mic. Good morning. My name is Rias Rivera, and I am here on behalf of Oregon School for the Deaf as an alumni. I would like to share a little bit about my family background and myself. I have deaf parents. I have a sister who has also graduated from OSD who is deaf. My father is still working as a foreman for the steel mill and company in Portland. He's been doing that for 33 years. My mother, she works as a teacher's assistant in a deaf program in Portland. And my sister right now currently is working full-time as a special education teacher at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside. I went to Gallaudet University, and I got my BA degree in psychology. I started my first job in California School for the Deaf in Fremont as a supervisor counselor for 5 years.
Later, I was offered work for MCI, Global Relay, as an outreach coordinator, education specialist, for 1 year. I decided wanting to continue with my education field. Currently, I am working to get my master's in deaf education at Western Oregon University. I am truly grateful to have the opportunity to enroll in Oregon School for the Deaf because it makes a difference in my life. OSD gives me a strong sense of deaf identity and belief in myself and the ability to function effectively in deaf and hearing communities. It is the only place where I could not feel any barriers in my learning and communication. What does it make the difference in? The teachers are qualified and trained to meet a variety of deaf and hard of hearing students' educational needs. I was able to acquire complexities of sign language interaction in varying settings, from classrooms, outside the classroom, social, meeting, sports, and after school activities. That is how hearing children would feel when they are in a public school. We would like to have your continued full support for providing a service of holistic education experience for our future deaf and hard of hearing students. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Scott Poth, and I'm here. I am an alumni from OSD. I graduated in 1997. After graduation, I went to Gallaudet University, and I graduated last May. I went to Gallaudet University. It is the only and largest deaf college in the world. I am now a student at Western Oregon University for a master's. Reyes and I just happen to be in the same class. There are many deaf in it. Let me see where I am. Okay. Why is OSD important? Well, OSD means a lot. And why is that? The teachers are fluent in sign. That means the children can receive without any frustrations and learn without any anger. It's easy to express what they want. It's not just a one-way communication. I mean, I've experienced mainstreaming school, and wow, mainstreaming is much, much different. I mean, I've experienced mainstreaming for 5 years. And throughout that entire time, my frustration increased. It was a great experience, but I went back to the deaf school. And after going back to the deaf school and experiencing both, I really liked OSD. Because the teachers at the deaf school, you know, they really influenced me to make my decision to become an educator of the deaf. You know, I want to raise the bar for the education for the deaf. I want to make it possible for the other students to be successful. OSD provides school, athletics, job training, good networking with other deaf schools, opportunities, and really cool sharing of the deaf culture. The deaf culture cannot be bought. You cannot buy that. First, I really want to thank all of you for your support of OSD since 1970. Excuse me, interpreter error, since 1870. Since then until currently, the history of OSD has meant a lot. And you, legislation, are that reason. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great testimony. Right.
Good morning, Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Messenger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon School for the Blind. I was asked, I'm a parent there of a student, and I can't help but feel very grateful to be here today. I've never partaken of something like this, and I just am so impressed with these individuals, whatever their aspect or their input, wherever they're coming from. Wow, what a lot of character, what a lot that each person has to put into our community and to our society. I'm coming as a parent of a child who has been attending OSB for the past 7 years. Nicholas turned 21 in February and will be graduating from OSB in June. Our family has been so impressed and so grateful for our son to have the wonderful opportunity to attend this school, where not only are his vision needs addressed, but the staff are all trained in facilitating his progress for the other areas where Nick is disabled, which are physical and mental. Nick's years at OSB have been imperative to his progress in the life skills and the independence he has gained as a direct result of the dedication of this outstanding staff. These teachers, assistants, and all who meet my son's needs and the needs of all students at OSB have demonstrated to me not only their educational expertise, but their personal dedication to caring for the whole person, body, soul, and spirit. These teachers, administrators, nurses, assistants, even janitors come to teach and assist at OSB, and they stay. This is where they stay, to utilize their skills, many of them for 20 to 30 years already, then retiring from a career that has brought great fulfillment. Everyone who is making decisions for the Oregon School for the Blind and the Deaf should visit the schools and see the excellence in which these schools operate and the wonderful feeling of family which exists there. These children and young adults are some of our finest citizens. They thrive in bodies where vision, hearing, and sometimes other normal bodily functions are not taken for granted. They are given opportunity by these amazing instructors and other professionals to rise above their disabilities and to learn all they can to function in a world where nothing is simple to them or easily conquered. I have personally witnessed the skills of these teachers and their students in action. These individuals need the dedication, knowledge, and concern of staff who will stick by them as they experience the obstacles in their world, while at the same time teach them the tools they need to navigate and succeed in the world where they exist. These schools have the great blessing of staff that are not afraid to step up to that plate. I beseech you to consider what could be jeopardized if these schools were to receive future funding cuts. Do yourself a favor. Visit the schools. You will be blessed and awakened. I am very proud that our state has schools which accommodate students and individuals where life and accomplishment are never taken for granted. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Great panel. Chair calls Glenn Larson, Christy Reichel, and Larry Hall. On deck is Josh Harlukowitz, Evelyn Brzezinski, and John Fine. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this morning in support of the regional programs. I've had the opportunity of being the current chair of the Willamette. Pardon me?
For the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Glenn Larson.
Thank you.
I've had the opportunity of being the current chair of the Willamette Regional Advisory Committee and have in the past also served as chair of the Southern Oregon Regional Advisory Committee. I've been involved with regional programs off and on for the past 18 years.
If I might interrupt here, we have a call of the House members. Senator Mesley, if you would be so kind as to carry the gavel until we return. Please proceed, okay. And we'll be back as soon as we're relieved of the call.
Proceed. In our district, in the past 5 years, I've utilized regional staff with expertise from all areas of services, autism, hearing impairments, orthopedic impairments, and vision impairments. Without access to the regional programs, our district could not provide the services these students require and deserve at the same level of quality provided by the Willamette regional programs. There are several reasons for this. First, it is much more cost-effective to provide low-incidence support from a regional program. There is an economy of scale that allows regional programs to provide the variety of services necessary for this student population that can only be realized through a regional approach. The cost to smaller mid-sized school districts to contract privately with individuals skilled in addressing the needs of these students is prohibitive. Small and mid-sized districts do not have enough students with high needs, low incidence disabilities to warrant employing full-time specialists to serve these students. Additionally, there is a nationwide shortage of most specialists needed to provide services to these districts. As a district needing only part-time specialist assistance, it would be very difficult to attract highly sought-after professionals. It is also very apparent to me that having the support of the professional staff from the regional programs has helped our district avoid costly litigation. Their expertise and ability to provide staff training and service to students has assisted our district from inadvertently violating student rights. The needs of the students served by the regional programs are challenging, and the requirements for providing services to all children are stringent. As you struggle with the continuing budget processes, I urge you to provide adequate funding to the regional programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Larry Hall from Kaiser.
I'm here to speak on behalf of the Student Leadership Development Center grant in aid. I'm currently retired after 38 years in public education and private industry. You can see on the first paragraph of what I handed you some of my other credentials as former director of the center, former director of Oregon DECA and FBLA, and I'm currently serving as chair of the Board of Trustees for Oregon FBLA and consulting with Oregon DECA. Like other programs you've been hearing about today, the Student Leadership Center directly touches local teachers and local students. It's just not an administrative program. As some of the students before me and some that you'll hear, I can talk for hours about the successes of students that have gone through the different programs, the students that have graduated from high school that would not have, except for their involvement in the organization. The one of our FBLA members from Mississippi is currently governor of that state. One of the former FBLA state presidents from North Bend was on the staff of two different congressmen from our state, a former U.S. senator and candidate for national president, and is now currently serving one of our Oregon U.S. senators. Involvement in with DECA as a classroom teacher changed how I taught. These student organizations are not extracurricular activities such as athletics and cheerleading. While athletics and cheerleading, I could go on about the benefits of those two programs also, but they are purely extracurricular in nature. Our technical professional student organizations are an integral part of the curriculum and co-curricular in nature. Teach as a DECA advisor, I use DECA as a teaching tool to make education relevant to students. Students learned how to take knowledge from other classes, put it together, and through their projects and learning by doing, learned how to apply these knowledge and skills to real-life situations. Student Leadership Development Center impacts over 11,000 students and over 480 teachers in virtually every high school in the state. These programs, if they're cut, they'll force a major reduction in the linkages between school and the business and industry community. Currently, business and volunteer efforts over 18,000 hours, allowing or looking at the equivalent of 9 FTEs over 12 months through the year. The Student Leadership Center budget recently did take a cut with the early reductions earlier in this year and have cut staff time. They've moved their offices to less expensive areas, trying to take this reduction into effect. Currently, Oregon DECA and FBLA have a one full-time staff person for each organization with no secretarial support. Other organizations have less than one FTE staff person. A further reduction in budget would jeopardize this minimal levels of support. The staff and office expenses are paid out of their current budget. All other costs, such as printing, things that go directly to the benefit of students, are raised through student fees and industry financial and volunteer contributions. But those of us as volunteers can only do so much. The elimination of funding could result in a yearly loss of in-kind over $510,000 per year in in-kind and financial services from business and industry. Leadership Center plays a major role in professional development for teachers and advisor training. A direct loss would result in some of the students that you see behind me not being able to perform their duties as state officers, reduction in student achievement in the local schools, and I highly recommend that you include the Student Leadership Development Center as a grant in aid in your Department of Education budget.
Thank you. Ed?
committee members. My name is Christy Reel. I'm from Salem, and I'm a parent of a 5.5-year-old daughter with disabilities. My daughter was born with a metabolic disorder that's very rare, and she had constant seizure activity until we discovered that she needed mega doses of vitamin B6. She regressed to a newborn state. She was completely unresponsive. She's now diagnosed with mild to moderate autism. She gives hugs. She loves Silver Falls Park. And you've heard many things about how important early intervention and early childhood education is. We moved here from another state, which has much more funding than Oregon. But I have to tell you, I have been incredibly impressed with the services we have received in Oregon. With a relatively small amount of funding, you have professionals that do amazing things. Our daughter has made more progress in the past 9 months here than she did in our former state. I want to emphasize to you that funding for special education is so important. It tells us what our society is really about. And I would love for Oregon to be known as a state that really cares for those who cannot care for themselves. I also want to emphasize and ask in this really difficult budget crisis that I know you're facing that you remember why you went into public service. As you consider difficult choices, for those of you who believe in the right to life, I'm sure that you're aware that many decisions to end a pregnancy are based on test results which indicate a child may have a disability. Would you have couples choose to keep their disabled child and then not give them the supports they so desperately need? For those of you who entered public service to help those who cannot help themselves and who believe that society and a government have a responsibility to do that, we ask you to remember that such a responsibility requires at times a tangible sacrifice on the part of those who are able to help themselves. That, I believe, is the measure of a great society. We do understand that you're in a horribly difficult situation where sacrifices will have to be made in order to make the budget process work. We thank you for being willing to listen to our stories in order to make well-informed decisions that will be in the best interest of all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call Josh Harlikovich, Evelyn Brzezinski, and John Fine. On deck will be Margaret DeLacy, Howard Rill, if I'm saying that right, and Kay Steele. Go ahead.
Hello, members of the committee. My name is Josh Harlikovich, and I'm speaking on behalf of FBLA and DECA. I am a member of the Central High School Chapter of DECA, an association of marketing students. I am as well president of the Central High School Chapter of FBLA, Future Business Leaders of America, which are funded at the state level through the Student Leadership Development Center. I must admit, I am not a straight-A student, but I, as well as some of my teachers, believe that I have a successful future ahead. I owe this to my experience within the business organizations, FBLA and DECA. With competitive events such as marketing role plays and multimedia events, I obtained some of the real-world situation experience. Take the experience of real-world situations and the knowledge of a classroom education, and you have the makings for a successful future. The experience of each includes fundraising, community service, and conferences from statewide to national. If you want a long-term fix, look at the future. Look at us. 20 or 30 years now from now, you'll be retired in Florida, and we, the students, will be in your seats. I say give us the leadership experience that we need to improve ourselves, to improve Oregon. Please support FBLA and DECA. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ma'am?
Good morning. I'm Evelyn Brzezinski. I'm Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment at Portland Public Schools, and I appreciate you staying here past the time you thought you were going to be leaving. Unlike everything else you've heard this morning, I don't have a human face to put on what I'm going to talk about. What I'm talking about is some suggestions that have been made to the legislature that the Oregon Department of Education contract with a national test publisher to produce their statewide assessment tests rather than to keep the development and implementation of that program in-house. That idea has come to you before, has come to the legislature before, and I have never been moved to drive to Salem to tell you why I think that is a bad idea. But I wanted to do it today because with the passage of the No Child Left Behind Act, there has been a real sea change in the requirements for testing of students' academic achievement. I've been in this field for about 30 years, and the No Child Left Behind regulations regarding testing have made things so different compared to what I certainly grew up with in tests and possibly what you grew up with tests and in the first 25 years of my experience in this field. No Child Left Behind requires states to have specific statements of the content that students are expected to learn at various points during their school career. And then they have to have tests that measure those specific statements. By moving to a national test publisher for a test, we would be faced with two choices. Either we need to adopt the content domain, if you will, that national test publisher has chosen to put in the test, or we have to pay the test publisher to modify the test so that it specifically matches the content standards that we have had in this district, in this state, for a dozen years. Both of those, either of those, would be a tremendous waste of resources. I don't know whether you have been given cost estimates of using a national test publisher. The data I've seen say that it would not be less expensive than the cost of our program now. But if it is, if you have seen different data, I want to make sure you understand that the costs you've seen are for an off-the-shelf test. They are not for the tailored to Oregon's content standards, and that would require much more money to produce those kind of tests, and we would not have some of the programs that you've heard other people talking about, namely TESA. If, on the other hand, you thought that we should throw out the content standards that we have and have used in the last decade, let me tell you about the tremendous impact that would have on district resources, district budgets. We have spent, it's not just, the decision about how to fund a statewide assessment program is not just an issue for the Oregon Department of Education budget, but it affects every district's budget. For the past decade or more, we have planned professional development activities, we have selected textbooks, we have developed local assessment measures to match those content standards. If we no longer have those content standards, it means we have to start over. You know what the funding situation is in local districts. I don't think anyone would expect that to be the highest priority, but it's something that we would have to do. I will follow up with a letter outlining some of these reasons and some additional ones that I don't want to take the time now to talk about, but I really would encourage you to think very strongly before deciding that we should throw out the state assessment program we have and move to something else, especially now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Chairman Morgan and members of the committee, my name is John Fine, and I am here as the elected representative of the 15,000 members of the Oregon State Grange. The Oregon State Grange is, as their representative, is in support of maintaining the Student Leadership Center and the functions that the Student Leadership Center does for the students of the state of Oregon. And they believe very strongly that the functions of that Student Leadership Center are very important. In 1995, the delegates that represent these members from throughout the state passed a resolution mandating that I and other members that are involved in the legislative process make every effort to secure stable funding for the Student Leadership Center, and that's part of the reason why I'm here today. One of the goals that we talked about in school improvement was to have practical leadership development training for all students. The Student Leadership Center is critical to the leadership activities for all the professional technical student organizations, and to make sure that they maintain their integral part of the instructional program. Other people have talked today about how the leadership activities relate to the instructional program. The Student Leadership Center is very critical to making sure that that continues to happen. I spent, before I came to this particular position, 30 years as an agriculture teacher and FFA advisor, and I can tell you that the services that the student leadership provided were essential for things like workplace learning,
our supervised agricultural experience programs to make sure that the students had those opportunities to become what, in my mind, what education is all about. Our real focus of education is to turn every one of our students into a productive individual and to help them become employable. The coordination of all the career development events that is provided by the Student Leadership Center provides those students with an opportunity to showcase that classroom instruction and to make sure that they have the opportunity to use the examples they've learned in the classroom in a real-world situation.
30 seconds, sir.
The Grange also is strongly supportive of making sure that the Student Leadership Center is maintained within the Department of Education instead of housed at other places. On behalf of the Oregon State Grange, I would like to thank you for your time. I know that this is a very difficult situation, but we would like to continue or to request that you continue to support the Student Leadership Center and the activities that they provide to so many young people throughout the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I call Margaret DeLacy, Howard, and it could be Rao or Rao, R-A-L-L, or R, some value, L, or vowel, L-L, and then Kay Steele. And on deck is Lori Wimmer Whalen, Gordon Drake, D-R-A-K, I guess it is Drake, and Diane Drake from the School of the Blind. I think you're the only one that's going to be here.
I saw Lori earlier. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret DeLacy, and I'm here as the legislative chair for the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. Can you all hear me? Okay. I'm here today to request an amendment to House Bill 5015 to restore the grant and aid to Talented and Gifted Services in Oregon that would slightly lower than the amount that they received the previous several biennia. If you cannot support this amendment, Senate Bill 849 was just amended to accomplish the same goal, but it uses general fund dollars instead. I want to tell you today that I believe, and after listening this morning, I think you'll agree with me, that Oregon does have world-class students. Unfortunately, we are not offering them a world-class education, despite testimony you may have heard from the Department of Education. In addition, I'm very concerned about the lack of equity in resources for talented and gifted education across the state. We're seeing more and more small districts ceasing to fund any talented and gifted activities. We're seeing very large regional discrepancies from place to place. And our TAG department has been working very hard to provide services to students throughout the state, utilizing other networks such as OPEN, for example. We'll be demonstrating some of the new curriculum that is available through OPEN next week. I think there are three reasons that your committee should support excellence in education in our state by funding services to high-achieving students, even in these tough fiscal times. First, because it's been very well demonstrated that failing to provide appropriate instruction hurts children. It doesn't hurt them just academically, it hurts them socially and emotionally as well. Second, because providing excellent K-12 education is an essential component of Oregon's hopes for economic growth. The Oregon Economic and Community Development Department report to the Emergency Board last year stated that the effectiveness of our K-12 schools will, in the long run, have more positive economic benefit than any other state action. The Oregon Progress Board commented that Oregon needs a truly world-class workforce to compete effectively in today's global economy. The modest improvements that Oregon has made in education are inadequate to satisfy those needs, and that's before these cuts. Unless we prepare our case...
2 seconds, ma'am.
Okay. Finally, we must strengthen TAG programs, because if we don't, we're simply wasting our education money. There is no point in spending money to keep children sitting in classrooms day after day, month after month, and year after year being taught things that they have already mastered. One in four of our students exceeded the benchmarks on the state standardized tests. We have no idea what services are being provided for those students because right now we're not asking districts to tell us that. If we expect the Department of Education to provide accountability, we have to provide the staffing and services to make sure that that happens in the districts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Chair once again calls Howard Rao and Kay Steele. Are either of those people here? I'll go ahead then to Lori Wimmer, Whalen, Gordon Drake, and Diane Drake. Lori, please proceed.
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. Happy to be back here again. It's a tough act to follow, that room full of wonderful people who have been here before you this morning, and I will try very hard not to duplicate anything they have said to you, and you do have my written testimony. On behalf of Oregon Education Association's 44,000 members, I'm here to ask you for full funding for the Department of Education's operations budget and also the grant and aid budget. We believe that the students in Oregon's 198 school districts deserve the many direct and indirect services that are provided adequately when state departments of education are funded adequately. As you've heard from so many others, there are a lot of programs at stake with respect to these budget deliberations, including TAG and regional programs and early intervention special education, technology education, Head Start and Pre-K. The list goes on and on. We care very much about all of those services that are provided, again, directly or indirectly through technical support and so forth with the department. And I came to also offer you our perspective on the work of the Department of Education under the new leadership. It's been our pleasure to work with the Superintendent of Public Education and her staff. Our members and our leadership folks have been able to collaborate and work with and receive services from the new regime and are very pleased with that partnership and have built a trust relationship. We've been happy to be able to provide input. They've worked with our Teaching and Learning Center, which is focused on curriculum instruction and diversity training and all sorts of other things. And there has been quite a good relationship there, and I'd like to put that on the record. Finally, I wanted to observe that with respect to the conversations I've been witnessing in the last few days with respect to the state assessments, we just wanted to offer to weigh in just a little bit on that issue. We really believe that over time, that the testing system, that this is a teacher-developed long-term project that has received tremendous resources on the part of the state and its educator workforce over time. And that has really developed and become something with which our members are familiar. They believe it's beginning to work very well. And the idea of moving to an off-the-shelf textbook company-derived test, throwing out all of that investment that we've already made, would be penny-wise and pound-foolish. And so I would just put that on the record. Finally, I wanted to remind the committee, as I have twice before on other budgets, that there is another way. We don't have to cut these budgets. The Oregon Revenue Coalition has identified over $2 billion worth of revenue that you can recover out of the $27 billion you will be giving away in 350 tax credits in the next biennium. And we urge you to look at that revenue solution and speak to your colleagues about that so that you can deliver budgets that fully fund these programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to the Drakes, let me, the next panel up will be Chris Hateman, Tamara Watrous, and Richard Famdo. And please.
Yes, my name is Gordon Drake, and I thank you for the time to speak on behalf of the Oregon School for the Blind. I have a son, my wife and I do, who's 16. He did go to early intervention, and he was in the regular school system. At time he was 9 years old, they were going to keep him back another grade, keep him in the same grade. And we found out, it just wasn't working in the regular school system, so we had him tested at the Oregon School for the Blind and got him enrolled before to get him in there. Consequently, within a year's time, his progress has been unbelievable and exciting. We praise the staff members and everybody that works at the school for the love and understanding they have for each of the children that go there. And each year as we go and each day we go in there, we see such a difference in other children and the progress that they take and the love they give to them and to teach them. Living abilities and such things as that, they work with us to help us so that he has a future rather than being just a person. And I hope the funding keeps going for the Oregon School for the Blind.
Thank you very much.
There's not much more I can say except for the school's done wonders with our son. They've got him to where he's independent. He can...
Would you kindly identify yourself for...
My name is Diane Drake.
Thank you.
And they've done so much for him. He's got to where he's able to dress himself, make a bed. They teach him to cook and all this stuff so that they can be an independent person. And when he was in the school system, his mobilist that came in said she didn't see for my son to have a future, that he would have to be put into a place where they would take care of him. Now he's a productive person that can do things and stuff and eventually will be a productive person in the society.
Thank you. Thank you. I call Chris Haydeman, Tamara Watrous, and Richard Bambo. And on deck is Mary Ciccini, Danny, which looks like Camilla Peller, and Paula Bryant-Therese. Please begin.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me the time to speak. My name is Chris Heidemann. My daughter Mia, now 6, was born with severe to profound hearing loss, so I'm here to speak on behalf of OSD and its programs. Profound is the greatest degree of loss. She has severe to profound, to give you an idea of where she lies in the spectrum of hard of hearing and deaf. Because of this and other factors, we have chosen to educate her using American Sign Language, as she does not have sufficient hearing to benefit from oral approaches. Thus, ASL is her first language. When she left the preschool at Columbia Regional Program in Portland, we had a choice. We could have Mia attend the elementary school at which her older brother attends there locally in near Portland, or have her commute to OSD in Salem every weekday. So the elementary school, very good, very close. My wife and I are both involved, very easy to be involved in that school. But imagine being the only student in the entire school who speaks a foreign language, say Japanese or Spanish. Imagine that it's impossible for you to learn to understand or say any of the words of that foreign language. So it would be for my daughter in a typical elementary school. She would have no direct interaction with her peers or her teacher. She would be able to communicate only through an interpreter. The interpreter would have to attempt to translate spoken language into ASL and ASL into spoken language and do that simultaneously. So imagine trying to do that with communication between six-year-olds. Imagine the impact on Mia's self-esteem on her world when she realizes she is the only one who needs this other person to follow her around to communicate with her peers, with her teachers, with her friends. So fortunately, there is another option. There's a much better option, and for us, that option is OSD. So we have Mia commute almost an hour each way to go to OSD to benefit the community here. Again, the academic reputation is excellent. Mia here at OSD is surrounded by kids with whom she interacts naturally. She is not different. She is not disabled. She is not at a disadvantage in that academic environment. These are the reasons that it is critical that the programs of deaf education at OSD be maintained. If not OSD, my daughter really has no other choice. As you can see, she'd be the only person at her local school who is different. So let me talk a little bit about the academic environment at OSD. As I've said, she interacts there with peers and her teachers using ASL, using her language. She interacts with librarians, the PE teacher, the speech teacher, all the specialists.
30 seconds.
Okay. Using ASL. Excuse me. She interacts directly, whereas she would require an environment, an interpreter in any other environment. Furthermore, MIA's teachers are trained to teach the deaf. They are trained to educate deaf kids in writing, math, history, geography, whatever. They have audiologists. They have reading. They have they have specially trained teachers to teach kids whose language is ASL to read English. Again, think you know Japanese. All your books that you're presented with are in English. That's what my daughter and other deaf students go through. So let me conclude by summarizing that OSD is critical for my daughter's education because she has an environment of her peers and because she has a school with teachers and specialists who understand what it is to be deaf.
Thank you very much. Very good testimony. Ms. Watrous.
Hi. Thank you for letting us be here today. My name is Tamara Watrous, and I'm here on behalf of my son, Jacob, who is 8 and a half, and he is currently a student down at OSD also. We found out he was deaf when he was about a year old, and we weren't sure why. There was no illness. There was no hereditary deafness in the family or anything, and it came as quite a surprise. We went through early intervention, and he did okay in that program. It had a little bit of a standstill for him, and we decided this year that OSD would be the best placement for him. He also has Asperger's syndrome, which is a very high-functioning autism. At OSD, he is just one of the kids, and he loves his friends. He communicates with his friends. He can communicate with his teachers, and he can get his point across, and everyone knows him and all of his little quirks that come along with being an Asperger's child kind of threw a wrench into the whole thing because he's deaf, and so looking at somebody is very important when you're deaf because you get a lot of information from the face and from the body. And, well, because he has the Asperger's, he would not look at people. And so at first everyone thought, you know, he's a behavioral child and he has, all these other problems. And then, you know, they really look at him and said, well, he's deaf and he's this. But, you know, all these kids are deaf. So that's not an issue we'll focus on here. And he is just doing wonderful. He's reading. He's writing. He's on a Challenger League T-ball team. And he communicates with his little brother. And, you know, it's great. And without OSD, he would not be doing as well as he is doing. And that is his love. And he would rather be sick at school than stay home with mom all day and be bored with mom. So it is very important for the deaf kids and the deaf community to have OSD as, just as a good, solid base for them. And it's very important for those kids.
Thank you
very much.
May I comment that your son is wonderfully
deaf? Thank you.
Sir.
Hello, my name is Richard Fando. I attend Lake Oswego High School. I have been a member of Oregon DECA for 2 years now. DECA is an association of marketing students funded by the Student Leadership Development Center. It offers a wide variety of benefits to young people. DECA members are prepared for the real world by co-curricular programs DECA offers. I currently serve as the Oregon DECA Publicity Director. DECA is directly responsible for installing confidence, real-world experience in the business and marketing fields, and leadership skills in me. I'm here returning yesterday from Florida at a national conference for ICDC. 242 Oregon delegates attended, competing in marketing and occupational events. DECA is in every state, including Germany, Canada, Puerto Rico, and Guam. In this conference, I have gained skills from representing my state and attending a leadership development conference. DECA is not only benefiting members, it gives back to the community. Civic consciousness projects offer support to the community that DECA does throughout the year. One such project raised $115,000 for Dornbecker Children's Hospital. Oregon DECA supports members and the community, and I pray that Oregon will support this organization. I would also like to take this time to extend my support to every educational leadership organization here today, for they are responsible for the future of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I call next Mary Ciccini, Danny Mella-Pelton, I know I've massacred that name, and Paula Bryant-Ruiz. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Ciccini, and I'm here representing DECA and the Student Leadership Development Center. I'm currently the Oregon DECA District 1 Vice President. DECA is an organization of marketing that focuses its co-curricular education on marketing, management, and entrepreneurship. There are currently 1,800 members in Oregon and over 22,000 members internationally. Like Richard said, we have both just returned from the International Career Conference in Orlando, Florida last night, which featured the top 13,000 marketing students internationally and, proud to say, 242 delegates from Oregon. The state currently spends money on required courses in high schools, such as CURLEY programs, focused programs of studies, senior projects, and professional development courses, and other programs to prepare Oregon students for our future. DECA students are the standard in which Oregon strives to have all students achieve. DECA, FFA, and FBLA students are mature, confident, smart, they're civic leaders, they have vocational understanding, they're very good extemporaneous speakers. DECA and other similar student leadership organizations give Oregon students the key to take Oregon in the right direction. Please make the first decision to make Oregon education, to take Oregon education on the right track for our futures. We are the future students of Oregon. Please decide how you like to see us look.
Thank you very much. And this brings us to the end of the sign-up sheets that we have for testimony. Is there anyone left out there who signed up and who didn't get called? If you're in that category, please come forward. And if there's anyone that didn't sign up that does want to testify, please come forward at this time also. And seeing no one making any move whatsoever.
Madam Chair, my constituent, Paula Bryant, is part of the Teddy Bear Brigade here in support of early education and early intervention. And so she's probably out about spreading teddy bears, but I did want to note that she was here in support of that.
Thank you very much. And I would also like to thank the translators who have done extremely hard duty here today, and I really appreciate the service being available to people. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5014 and House Bill 5015 and adjourn the subcommittee meeting, and we will reconvene at 8:30 on Monday morning.
Unless they call the house. We're behind. Hearing, and we're not the extra TV.